Good morning, everybody. Rishus Bardas, Rabbi Hellman, Rabbi Sablowski, our honored guest. I'd like to welcome everyone for coming this morning. First, I'd like to thank the sponsor. Our sponsors, the Anonymous Friends of the Kreilu, appreciate Zchus HaBasas Torah. Before we begin, just a announcement. The Kreilu's next Yom Iyun will be at the Kreilu in 2 weeks. March 13th, Rav Yosef Berger from Baltimore is giving a shiur at 9:15 with Chavrusas, learning with Ingolite. 10 o'clock, the shiur is going to be on Kedushas Shem, keeping erasing Hashem's name on a computer and Shemos, etc. And there's a special lady shiur at 11 o'clock on makeup on Shabbos and personal hygiene. Any questions, you can contact us at the Kreilu. This morning, as a very, very important shiur, we're very happy Rabbi Sablowski came had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. He's Baruch Hashem very busy. He's a Marbet Steyer. She was in Reitz and a Rav of Erbik Shum Bergenfield. I was there once. He was Machnas Erechmi and our family. So to come here is like, it's not, you know, Baruch Hashem, he has plenty of work to do in New Jersey and New York. So we're very makatayv that a man of his stature, as you do it for a sefer and his shurim online and yeshiva and his shul, to come is a tremendous chus for us. The topic they're discussing, the Rambam says in his Hakdama, when he discusses the different svarim, mada, zmanim, and ava, etc., he says in Kedusha, there are two things that the Rambam writes in Kedusha, Yisuri Bia and Macholos Asuras, kashrus and relations. Those are the two things that the Rambam says is Kedusha, that's the Abdel Eschem in Amim. That's what brings Kedusha. This brings Kedusha in our lives. When we have proper kashrus and we keep Taras HaMishpach, we keep relations, proper relations on Pitaras HaKadosh. And a lot of times people, they don't learn well before their wedding. Even if they learn very quickly. And then if the wife, Baruch Hashem, gets pregnant, and then they push it, and we tend to forget. They say, oh, it's a wife's business, and you know, and the husband takes a back seat. But it's both vigilant. The husband's mechuyev. It's the same. It's his responsibility as well. His isser. So we have to always review the halachas, be cognizant of these halachas, be medakted them properly. Obviously, the shiur is only not comprehensive shiur. Just we'll have a break for an hour. We'll speak for an hour at Sablowski and have a question and answer maybe, and then have a break for a couple minutes until 12 to finish. Any other wants to learn extensively, please come to me, and we'll find the chavrus in the kreilu. Obviously, any shiurs you have, you can speak to your local rav. Without further ado, Rav Sablowski.
Thank you so much for the introduction, Bishus, Harabanim. So I'm going to try to do what I guess would probably be deemed an impossible task, to try to summarize all of the Kusnida in the next 2 hours plus, but we'll try to do our best. At 12 o'clock, you let me know whether we did at least, hopefully, a half-decent job. So let's start from the very beginning. The Gemara is actually not the beginning of the Masechta, it's close to the end of the Masechta, but we'll start from the beginning, really the introduction to Hilchos Nida. But the Gemara tells us at the end of Masechas Nida that there are really two different ways that a woman can become a Nida. One is on a level of Deraisa, according to the Torah law itself, and sometimes a woman only becomes a Nida on a level of Derabana. Practically speaking, she's going to be a Sura. Practically speaking, of course, Taras Mishpach is going to apply under both circumstances, but it's going to become very important for us to know, are we dealing with the question of a Nida Deraisa, or perhaps only what's called a Nida Derabana? What exactly is necessary for a woman to become a Nida min HaTorah? The Gemara darshins from a pasuk that the Re'iyas Dam, the seeing of blood, has to take place, what we call an Halacha Hargosha. There has to be some kind of a physical sensation, some kind of a feeling of some nature that accompanies the bleeding. Then and only then is the woman a Nida Midaraisa. If that Hargosha is missing, and for example, the Mishnah is described, the woman merely finds what we call an Halacha Kesem, a stain, a little bit of a spot, that for whatever reason is not accompanied by that Hargosha, then we're only dealing with the issue of Nida Midarabanan. What exactly does this mean practically for us? So we're not going to get into all the details as to what exactly is Hargosha, perhaps what's a questionable Hargosha, what's not a Hargosha. Suffice it to say as follows, when all the dust settles in the sugya of Hargosha, it basically boils down to the following principles, the Halacha. If a woman is having a significant amount of bleeding, which is usually associated with a regular period, we assume that by definition is considered to be the halachic equivalent of a hagosha. When a woman gets a regular period, so we label it, it's clearly a nida midaraisa, and some of the leniency, some of the kulas that we're going to talk about for a moment from now, are not going to apply when we're dealing with a real riyas dam midaraisa. So a regular period is considered to be riyas dam midaraisa. Even if a woman is not getting a regular period, but there is a significant amount of blood, which is a very, very tricky line in halach of demarcation, we're not really going to speak about right now, but this is something that's has to be discussed on a case-by-case basis. If there's a significant amount of bleeding, even if it's not in the context of a regular monthly period, that could also potentially be a needed diaraisa. So most of the time, 99% of the time, we're going to be dealing with real bona fide needed diaraisa questions. On a monthly basis, a woman is going to be a nida min hatorah. However, the area of ksamim, the area of stains, which are only midirabanan, are important lahalacha, because every once in a while, a woman does have ksamim, she has spots, she has stains, in the middle of a cycle, which are not associated with a halachic hagosha, and have to be dealt with a little bit different. As we go a little bit further on, when we talk about in the process of a woman becoming tahora, particularly counting during the week of Shiva Nakiyah and the seven clean days, very often there are spots and stains that have to be dealt with also using the rules of Hilchos Ksamim. So again, the basic starting point is that just about every month a woman is going to become a nida min haTorah. But nevertheless, it is important to know when we're merely analyzing, not what we call a flow of blood, not an actual period, but we're just analyzing a stain or a spot. So what exactly is the status of that? So it's clear from the Gemara that in the absence of a hargosha, it is only midirabanan. What is the significance that it's only midirabanan? So Chazal tell us, we have certain kulas, we have certain leniencies that we're allowed to rely on, and some of these leniencies become very, very relevant to halacha lemaisa today. So let's just go, we'll start off with some of the kulas in Hilchas Ksamim, and see how this is going to branch out for many, many shalas lemaisa and Hilchas Nida. So one of the clues in Hilchas Ksamim is, let's say for argument's sake, a woman finds a spot in the middle of the month sometime, when she's not necessarily expecting her period, she finds a stain, she finds a spot. So our initial reaction is, well, she's Asura. Because the Mishnah says that Midirabanan, a woman finds a stain, she finds a Kesem. So that's a problem, albeit Midirabanan. Nevertheless, the Mishnah tells us that what if she can be Tola this Kesem? What if she can assume, or she can guess, educated guess, that this stain may have come from somewhere else? She has reason to believe that this spot may have come from somewhere else. Not literally uterine blood. Perhaps it comes from an external source altogether. Or maybe even if it comes from an internal source, but only blood that comes from the uterine lining is considered to be damnidus. Sometimes a woman is bleeding from the cervical area, which is not technically, halachically, considered to be uterine blood. Sometimes she's bleeding from the vaginal area. She may be bleeding from the back part of her body, which is not from that area altogether. It may be confused where the source of the blood is. So the Mishnah tells us that as long as a woman can be tola, she can educated guess and say that this dam may have come, doesn't have to be certain, may have come from somewhere else, that's all right, that's permissible, and we can simply ignore that blood. How do we have a right just to be makel, just to be so lenient, so flippantly, maybe it's from somewhere else? Well, this is a throwback to what we said before. Since we're not dealing with a deraisadika problem anyway, because min haTorah, there was no hargosha, there was no significant blood, there was no real sensation, there was no real feeling, there was no period. It's just something a little bit out of the ordinary. So min haTorah, that wouldn't pose a problem altogether. Midirabanan, it poses a problem. And midirabanan, chazal lenient, provided that it's an acceptable, legitimate halachic taliyah. In case some people are wondering, sounds like a little bit too makel. I drove all the way from New Jersey to give you a big kula. So don't look at me strange, because they looked at Rabbi Akiva strange also. The Mishnah tells us that once Rabbi Akiva was sitting in the Beis Medrash, and a woman came with a shayla, and she said, I found the kesem, I found the spot. So Rabbi Akiva asked her, do you have maybe a makor? Do you have maybe a wound in that area? So she said, no, but I did at one time recently. So he said, well, has the wound healed yet? So she said, yeah, I think it healed. So he said, well, do you think it's a kind of a wound that may have reopened? So she said, yeah, it's possible. So he said, good, muteris, so you're permissible. So Ra Tamidim Mistakam Zebazet. So Rabbi Akiva saw the Tamidim and looking at him. What did the Rebbe just say? It's a Mikil, such a cooler. Rabbi Akiva so lenient. He's giving us all these Fedreta Talios. So Rabbi Akiva says, don't worry, I know what I'm doing. Dam Velo Kesem, he says, the Din in the Torah is that it's not considered to be a real Riyas Dam, because there's no Hagosha. And therefore, Midirabanan, as long as we have a respectable Taliyah, that would be acceptable. Taliyas are a very, very tricky area of halacha. They have to be brought to a Rav in order to ascertain, is this an acceptable Taliyah or not? Some of the very common Taliyos that we do use today, very often a woman goes for an exam, and sometimes the exam causes her to bleed, and then a day or two, all of a sudden she calls up frantic that she found blood. So the first question I'll ask him is, well, did you have a procedure called the pap smear? If you have a pap smear, very, very often women bleed from pap smears. The bleeding is not uterine, the bleeding is cervical, and therefore that's considered to be a macha, and we can just be told on the macha. Sometimes a woman will find blood, and find an underwear blood, and it turns out the blood is really coming from hemorrhoids. It's not even coming from that area. So as long as we know, we can't make up a story that she has hemorrhoids, but if she tells me that she has bleeding hemorrhoids, and every once in a while it bleeds, and she can't really tell where it's coming from, so that would also suffice as an acceptable tuliyah. So again, case-by-case basis, but a woman should be aware, just because she finds a spot, that does not necessarily mean she's asura. You have to present the shayla properly to see whether it's a valid tuliyah. Related to this principle of tuliyahs, is what the Gemara tells us in Maseches Nida, that if a woman finds a spot, she finds a stain in Kesem that's very, very small, she can assume that that's not a problem either. Why is that? So although the simple reading of the Gemara is that she can be tola, she can assume that it may have come from, this may not be the most sanitary discussion for us today, but in the days of Chazal, it was very common that he had bugs. They had one of these, were the official bed bugs of today. I can't tell you, I haven't done enough research into that. But the Gemara seems to describe something almost like bed bugs, that it was common that a woman would get up in the morning and she would find there were blood spots, there were ksamim on her sheets. So the Mishnah says that as long as the stains are fairly small, that we can attribute them to the size of blood of these particular bugs that were common, then we can be makil on this. So that's what's called a pachos mika gris. Gris is the size of the amount of blood of these bugs that Chazal was describing. In case one wants a reference point, so the reference point is about the size of a U.S. penny. I was any Rav Paskin or Chasnida always carries with him a trusted penny. I was very nervous a couple of months ago. There was something on the news about that the U.S. government thought they were going to start to phase out the minting of pennies. So I started to grab all the pennies to make sure I could give them a day. I've got the Messiah for every day, so I put them out of Paskin and Shiloh. So if a kesem is less than a gris, so then we assume that that's permissible as well. And again, the same reason. We're only dealing with a derabbanan anyway, and we have a right to be tola on the bugs. So some of you are probably wondering, that may have been true in the old days, when there were a lot of bugs floating around. Because manazeb, we would hope that we don't have so many of these bugs around their homes. So what right do we have to be tola on these bugs today? So the Chasam Sofer writes in the Tshuva, and basically a little bit more elaborates upon the basic gist of the Tshuva, is that Eilal Lahach Meyosa Me'aviseinu, namely, that this din derabbanan of Ksamim was instituted by a Beis Dragoda way, way back, thousands of years ago. The Chachamim instituted this gezeira, and Heimamu Veimamru built into this gezeira, they built in a kula. They were lenient that as long as it meets the criteria of being Pachas Megris, that is permissible. So Eilal Lahach Me'er, we're not Mechuyev to start making new gezeiras and more chumras b'zman hazeh. Whatever the status was in the olden days, since the whole thing is derabbanan anyway, so a pesha hitir, not exactly the halachic concept of that, but the same idea, that we're not mechuyev to build in more chumras into ilchus ksamim, and just as in the old days, less than a gris was permissible, less than a gris is permissible today as well. So this is a very, very common shayla. A woman finds a little bit of dam, let's say in her underwear, or sometimes other places, and she doesn't have any makas to be told on. She really has no idea where it came from, and between you and me, it most probably did come from the uterus. So we are almost certain that it's uterine blood, and we're going to turn around and say it's mutter anyway, because it's a kesem, there was no hagosha, it's only derabbanan, and it's less than a gris, so we're going to be okay with that. Looking whether a kesem is a gris or a pachas gris takes a little bit of training, because generally some don't present themselves in perfect circles. They usually present themselves a little bit of all over the place. So now the Rav has to evaluate whether it actually meets the shear of a gris or not. So this takes, again, a little bit of training, a little bit of expertise to be able to figure out, to hold up a penny and try to look and see. Well, a little bit of the penny is taken up by this part, a little bit of that part, and try to measure, try to maneuver around to see whether it's pachas gris or not. A very common shayla that comes up that Rabbanim have to deal with when they pass get on these shaylas of pachas begris is very often a woman will find a spot, and the spot is made up of a lot of different small spots. So she's got a little drop over here, and then a little drop over here, a little drop over here, and the question is, do they add up? Do you do the math? Do they add up together or not? So the answer is, it depends. It depends on, are they really, truly distinct, separate spots? If they're separate spots, then what we call in halacha, tipe tipin, literally droplets, and then they're permissible. You do not have to add them together. If they are connected in any shape or form to any colors, we didn't even talk about yet different colors of halacha, we'll get to that as we go on, but if they're connected in any shape or form, so then they would have to be all added up together. So again, this takes a little bit of training to figure out how to paskin the shailas properly. So just because a woman finds a kesem, the idea being, she shouldn't automatically assume, I found the kesem, found the same, also finished, done, have to wait 2 weeks, that's not true. It depends, case by case. Sometimes the kesem is paskin to be permissible, sometimes it's paskin to be prohibited. A rav has to look at it in terms of, Is there a valid taliyah? Is there something that we could rely on that it's coming possibly from somewhere else? Is it meet the size criteria? And then, as we mentioned before, one of the major questions that comes up throughout a chasnida is the issue of color. Not everything that comes out of a woman's body is automatically halachically blood. And even more radical than that, not all biological blood is necessarily halachic blood. The Gemara tells us that we have a tradition that only certain shades of red are considered to be problematic. Bizman Hazen, in today's world, I mean for the last 1500 years or so we no longer differentiate within shades of red, even though in the olden days, in the days of Chazal, so there were even certain shades of red itself that were not technically halachically problematic. Today, nobody, at least that I know of, really discerns within the red family, but we do discern within other types of colors. So very common, a woman will have, she'll find a stain, or other kinds of places she'll find blood, where the blood is red, that's a problem. If it's brownish, so then it depends. If it's yellowish, depends. If you're very, very careful to figure out exactly what the precise halachic colors are. And again, one has to have a training in this area to be able to learn from a Rebbe, to be able to see, this is a problematic color, this is a permissible color. So again, the idea being that just because a woman finds something, and even though it may even look a little bit reddish to her, she shouldn't necessarily jump the gun, jump to conclusions that it's necessarily usur. So it should be brought to a competent rav to be able to discern whether it meets the proper criteria in terms of the size, the shape, the color, etc. All these things go into paskening a shaila in hilchos nida correctly. There are several other kulas that are involved when we're dealing with the kesem. And again, the same, as we mentioned before, since this is only midirabbanan, there is no hargosha, so we have rights to be lenient on certain things, depending on where the kesem is found. The Mishnah tells us in Maseches Nida that if the kesem is found on something that is not subject to tuma, something that is not subject to the intricate laws of ritual impurity, so then all of the halachas of ksamim do not apply. So what does that mean practically for us? Well, depends where the kesem is found. If a woman finds a stain on her underwear, underwear is a garment, so a garment is subject to impurity, that would be a problem. What if a woman, the next the most common place for a woman to find a kesem is on toilet paper? Is that automatically considered to be a problem or not? So that was a big machlokes in the Peskim, whether paper is something that's subject to the rules of tumah, to the rules of ritual impurity. There are many Peskim more lenient than that. There are different traditions about that. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was lenient on that question, that our toilet paper is considered to be something which is so insignificant, it's just you use it once, you're disposable. So tissue paper, toilet paper, etc., those are things that are considered to be eina makabel tumah. If that's the case, so then all ksamim found on those items would not pose a problem. Again, this doesn't mean that if a woman is literally bleeding and she's having a period and it's all over the tissue, so then she could ignore that. No, we said before that if it's a nida min haTorah, then all of these leniencies don't apply. But if we're dealing with just a kesem, a sporadic spotting here and there, if it's found on tissue paper, there are poskim who are mekel. Not everybody, there are different traditions, different practices, from different rabbanim about this, but there are poskim who are lenient on these kinds of things. Other common applications of ksamim, which show up in things which are not mekabel tuma, are the Rama writes that if a kesem shows up in something that's connected to the ground, so one of the next common places where a kesem shows up is in a toilet bowl. So the toilet bowl is usually mechub l'kach, it's connected into the ground, and therefore wouldn't be subject to the rules of tuma v'tahara, and as such, it wouldn't be subject to the rules of ksamim as well. There are sometimes, and again, this is beyond the scope right now, sometimes nuances of when exactly the kesem is found, in what context of urination the kesem is found, which may complicate matters a little bit more. But again, it's important when a person is presenting a shaila to the Rav, the same way like when you go to the doctor, so the doctor's going to ask you certain questions, so you want to be able to give all the right information. So it's important not just to know that the size of the kesem, it's important for the Rav to know the size, it's important for him to know the color, and it's important for the Rav to know the location, where exactly the kesem showed up. So if it shows up on a toilet bowl, that may be a very, very different shaila than, even though it's biologically it's the same exact blood, it may be a very, very different question than if it shows up on underwear. One time I had a woman call me. I mean, it was a little bit humorous. I wasn't humorous for them, but a little bit of a strange shayla that a woman called me with a shayla. She started to present me the shayla that she found blood on the toilet bowl. And I was about to say, okay, well, you know, we can basically treat that as mechol b'lakarka. We can ignore it. But then, like a doctor, the rabbi has to be careful to ask all the pertinent questions. So I asked a little bit more, and then I came to the realization that she found it on a toilet bowl, believe it or not, on a toilet bowl on a plane. So a plane is not mechubal karka; it's up in the air. So it may, an airplane may not be mekabel tuma, depending on huchas tuma's mace, whether it's made out of aluminum or metal. It gets a very, very complicated shayla in terms of tuma tower of a plane. So I wasn't ready for that curveball. So I told her, let me just think about it for a little bit. The good news, I guess, and it's always the redeeming fact that huchas needed, that she's going back to a few hours later saying it wasn't a shayla anymore, it was mooch. I mean, I got a regular period, so there was nothing to discuss. But in theory, it would have been a labor to kishayla to try to paskin a kesem found on an airplane, but that's a double mekabel tuma. Anyway, there is another kula, which is a very, very relevant kula lahalacha for us. That's what the Gemara tells us, that if a woman finds blood on something that's called a begadim tzivonim, or anything that's really colored, if she finds blood on something that's colored, we could ignore that. Now again, this also must reiterate that this is only true if we're dealing with a kesem, we're dealing with almost a sporadic kind of a stay in the middle of nowhere. If a woman gets a period just because it comes up uncolored, that's totally irrelevant. And once a woman is telling me a story that she was told to wear colored underwear and she mamish had a period, she was mamish bleeding. So, isn't this a chorus? I said, that's not going to help. Begodim tzivonim only helps when you're dealing with something which is lacking hargosha. When you're having a real re'iyah min haTorah, then all the colors of the world is not going to help you. Why were Chazal so lenient that if you find the blood on colored garments that we could just ignore it? So Rashi says, because since color plays such a major role in terms of a chasnida, the difference, the nuances of red and brown and yellow is such so critical in terms of a chasnida, when you find something on a colored garment, it's going to be impossible to tell exactly what color it was. And therefore, since this is only midirabanan, it's always going to be an effect of suffix. You never really know whether it's the appropriate color that would pose a problem. So therefore, we have to just make on everything. The whole thing is midirabanan anyway. So Chazal were willing to be makel to let a woman declare that anything that's found on a devet savua is going to be permissible. This is very relevant for us, because the Rama quotes a practice that we used to follow today, that women should be recommended to wear tzivonim. It's the right thing for a woman to do to dafka, to specifically wear colored undergarments during the time of the month where she's in the terrace anyway. When she's getting a period anyway, it doesn't matter what she's going to wear. When she's in the week of Shiva Nikiyam, the seven clean days we'll talk about a little bit later, then she should specifically not be wearing colored. But during the rest of the month, 2 weeks or so of the month when she is Luteris anyway, so that it would be foolish for her to wear white, because if she's wearing white, she's only asking for trouble. So she may get a spot, very common, a woman sometimes gets a little bit of a spot in the middle of the month, and she's going to be in trouble, really for no reason, because she's not going to have a taliyah, it's going to be a little bit more than a gris, a garment is mekabel tuma, so she's going to be up the creek, so she's going to end up becoming a nida for really no reason. If she would have worn tzivonim, so then everything would have been okay. So the Rama says, she should tafka bitop. That's what we should tell the women. They should specifically wear colored garments during the week, part of the month that she's muteres. Why? She's not obligated to create problems for herself. So again, so we have a whole series of different leniencies that Chazal created for us, all working with the assumption that we don't have a real nida deraisa on our hands anyway. Once we have a nida deraisa, then all these kulos are going to fall by the wayside. But if we're only dealing with kesamim, so then every time we have a kesem, the woman, husband, the rav, everyone has to be on target to try to identify all these different factors. Are there tliyos that perhaps are necessary? And again, sometimes the tliyos are going to need a little bit of questioning, a little bit of investigating to see, is this a good tliyah, not a good tliyah? I know we have I'm a Rav in Tinek, so I have a woman who's a midwife in town, who I know I can always call on at all hours of the day and night, because sometimes you have a question, a woman calls with a shayla, she owes me a shayla, and I need a tliyah. I mean, she thinks, she's not sure, maybe there's something to be told on, we don't have any clarity, so sometimes you have to be mevar, you have to have somebody check them out. So very often, if you're going to wait until the next day or 2 days later, until a woman gets an appointment with a doctor to go get examined and see, is there a makas, is there some kind of a wound there? So many of the makas in that area tend to heal very quickly. So if she gets examined immediately, so we may find that she has a little bit of irritation, she has a little bit of something, and we'll be able to be mocked her right away, whereas otherwise it may cost her another 2 weeks. So taliyas, again, something the Rav has to be on top of to be able to identify properly. The pachas make a gris, again, it's also to figure out whether we have a gris, we don't have a gris. the Dvarma Makabal Tuma. So you have to always know and always ask what something is found on. I just reminded myself that we once had a Shaila. It was a very tricky Shaila about a kesem, a stain that was found on a polyester type of material. So polyester, 100% polyester, is technically not Makabal Tuma. For technical, intricate halakhic reasons, it's not subject to ksamim. The problem is that most of the polyester material has some cotton fibers in it also. I'm not an expert in the garment area and garment industry, but I was told that, I think just as in kashrus, you don't have to print every ingredient. If it's too little, you can get away without putting it on the label, so apparently the same is true in the garment industry. So you can have a very small amount of cotton fibers that are not listed, even though they're always there, or very often there. And that makes things very, very complicated. If you have a garment that has both polyester and cotton, then you're asking for trouble in luchos ksavim. So there was one time where we had a very convoluted, complicated shaila, and it all boiled down to one piece of information, whether the particular fibers on the edges of the garment were cotton or polyester. So the rabbi's got to do his homework, got to try to figure out, got to try to get all the information to try to figure out what exactly you're dealing with in order to pass it, whether something is mekabel tuma. So you have to know, are we dealing with a tliya? Are we dealing with a pachas begris? Are we dealing with mekabel tuma? Are we dealing with tzivonim? These are all the things that go into answering shalas in terms of hilchos ksamim. But the bottom line is that a woman, most of the time, a regular month, is going to become asura, she's going to become a nida, even without any of this stuff, because she's going to have a regular flow of blood, a significant flow of blood, a regular period, and we're going to declare that she is a nida min haTorah, or if once in a while she'll become a nida min derabanan, how do we get out of that state? So we gave the first 20 minutes or so how to get into the problem. Now we have to give at least equal amount of time how to get out of the problem. How does a woman become tahora once the halacha declares that she is a nida? So the Gemara tells us in the end of Maseches Nida that the halacha requires that any time a woman was paskin to become asura, either deraisa or derabanan, the only time she can become muteris, the only time she can become permissible to her husband again, is if she goes through the process of what's called shiva nekiyim. She has to count 7 clean days where the bleeding has, for all halachic practical purposes, has ceased. After those 7 clean days, then and only then can she go to the mikvah. This institution of shiva nekiyim is based on Pesukim and Chumash, actually. It's not always required in the Torah, sometimes yeah and sometimes no, depending on beyond the scope right now, but suffice it to say, it's always needed. That's absolutely not negotiable. There's nowhere in the world a woman can go to the mikvah b'zman hazeh without having passed the point of having shiva nekiyim. Sometimes it'll be a mamash, an absolute requirement deraisa, depending on when her cycle was and depending on how many days it was. It gets a little bit complicated, but because it gets complicated, that's exactly why the Gemara says that it doesn't make a difference anymore. Everything is required under all circumstances, so it's absolutely not negotiable. Shiva nekiyim are an absolute necessity before a woman can go to the mikvah. In order for shiva nekiyim to begin, so as their name connotes, it has to be 7 clean days. The only way to know that they're clean days is to know that the bleeding has stopped. How do you know that the bleeding stopped? So that's what the Mishnah tells us at the end of Maseches Nida. The only way to know for certain that the bleeding has stopped is that a woman has to check herself before the beginning of the 7 clean days. That's what we call in halacha a hefsek tahara. Even though those who learned the sugars in the end of Maseches Nida, Chazal called it a hafrasha b'tahara, and I'm not a knowledge as to exactly when in the last 1800 years that term switched. I'm not sure who first called it hefsek tahara, but if you learn the Mishnah calls it a hafrasha b'tahara, it's the same thing. We call it, colloquially today, we call it a hefsek tahara. That means, the hefsek tahara means that a woman checked herself internally. She took what we call a bedika cloth, a little white cloth, and she checked herself internally, and there's no blood on it. So as long as she does that before the 7 days begin, so now she's eligible to begin to count the 7 days. If she didn't do that, then she cannot even begin to count the 7 days. So that's absolutely also an absolute basic requirement the woman has to be aware of. Before she can start to count shiva nekiyim, the 7 clean days, she must do what we call an halacha hefsek tahara. When is the earliest time that she can do this hefsek tahara? So let's say, for argument's sake, if a woman would get her period, let's say on a Sunday morning, so she can't do the hefsek tahara until she stops bleeding, obviously. So usually most women bleed 5 days, 6 days, 7 days, 8 days, depending on the woman's cycle. So the halacha is that, first of all, the bleeding has to really stop. It's be absurd. She's doing hefsek tahara and she's still flowing with a lot of blood. That's going to be absurd. So when she senses that already things are coming to an end, it's pretty much over. So then she can begin to start to do a hefsek tahara. However, because of a whole series of technical halacha considerations, she has to wait until 5 days are over from when the period actually began. So let's say if she started to bleed on Sunday, so she has to count Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. By Thursday afternoon, she could do the hefsek tahara before the beginning of the next halachic day. So the 5th day of counting from when the bleeding began, that is the earliest time in halacha for her to do a hefsek tahara. That practice of waiting until the fifth day is a bare minimum of hefsek tahara is absolutely necessary almost all the time, in the following sense, that it's based on a combination of different factors that we got, again, beyond the scope right now, how we got to that magic number of five, and that's pretty much, under normal circumstances, an absolute requirement. There are certain very, very, very extenuating circumstances where Rav would have to be contacted as to perhaps, if it's possible, for the woman to almost shave off one of those days to potentially make hefsek tahara on day four. I'm not going to spend too much time about it because 99% of the time it's not relevant. Most women are not clean by day four anyway, so it's almost a moot question. But every once in a while you could have a scenario where there could be some very real, serious halachic reason to permit her to do a hefsek tahara a little bit earlier than normal. The reason that, at least in the past, used to be a fairly common discussion was if a woman would have very early ovulation. Very often if a woman has a very short cycle, so she will ovulate, and she could potentially ovulate before she goes to the mikvah. That's going to become very difficult. She'll never be able to become pregnant if she's always ovulating too early. So in the olden days, so when they realized that, I mean, the olden days, they didn't always figure that out when the woman was ovulating, but when they were able to figure out exactly when she was ovulating, and the woman's just missing it by a day, so the poskim discussed the permissibility of sometimes shaving off that fifth day, because that fifth day is not absolutely written in stone. Bizman is there, the question is almost moot for many, many reasons. First of all, most women don't get clean until after 5 days anyway, so it's not too relevant. And Bizman is there, if that's the issue that's preventing the woman from becoming pregnant, that's not such a serious issue. Medically, that can usually be taken care of easier than trying to cut down an ochus nida in a somewhat of a complicated way. So again, if a woman has a particular issue in this area that she senses that she's ovulating very early and she's having difficulty becoming pregnant, so she should definitely be in contact with the Rav, who can guide her as to what the possible approaches to that are. But again, this is Bizman Hazeh, not as relevant as it used to be. Under 99.9% of the time, we're going to insist on the woman having five absolute days from when the period began. Those who were from Sephardi backgrounds have a slightly different nuance to this practice. There are some Sephardic communities, and again, there are different ones in different communities, who have a little bit of a different standards in terms of this absolute necessity of this fifth day. They should contact their own poskim. There are different minhagim within different Sephardic communities about this. Again, it's not that relevant, so we're not going to spend too much time on it, because most women, no matter what, very, very rarely become literally clean anyway. So the fifth day is not, most probably not going to make it or break it anyway. So we're going to assume with regular standard approach that it's going to take a minimum of 5 days, and very often more, very often 6-7 days, before she can even do a hefsek tahara, before she can even begin to get to the point of counting 7 clean days. We mentioned before that the 7 clean days have to be preceded by hefsek tahara, and hefsek tahara must take place before the 7 days begin. Halachically, the day begins obviously at night, and therefore it is absolutely critical that the hefsek tahara be performed before the halachic night of the first of those days begins. When does the halachic night begin? So the Gemara tells us that once the sun sets at the time of Shkia, so that's already considered to be a suffix, that's already considered to be a doubtful, just as on Friday afternoon we would not do malacha after the sun sets, so too a woman should make sure to do a hefsek tahara before the sun sets of the first of those days that she wants to count as the first of the 7 clean days. There are different opinions in the poskim. If a woman, for whatever reason, missed the shkia, she missed sunset, and now it's a few minutes after sunset, can she still, after the fact, do a hefsek tahara? Depending on where you come from. So I don't want to poskim anything about Zman Hayom in Brookline. If they're in Brooklyn, the standards are a little bit different. But the standards that we come from, at least where the Misora, the tradition that I have, is that the sun sets when the sun sets. It doesn't hang up in the sky for a few extra minutes for the daf mincha or each al-shir, do anything else. Once the sun is done, it's done, it's finished, it's history. Somebody once told me that in Yerushalayim, they're very, very machmer in this. In Yerushalayim, the sun really sets. And somebody told me that they once asked Rav Nevinsel, the poskim of Yerushalayim, they asked Rav Nevinsel that apparently the wife had missed the shkia, she had missed sunset like 30 seconds. So they asked him, could we be lenient 30 seconds after shkia? So the way the person told me the story, Rav Nevinsel looked at the person like he just landed from the moon. Like he didn't understand. He said to him, Zachar Shkia. So if the sun says it, it's only 30 seconds. So he said, the conversation wasn't going anywhere. So the bottom line is that in many of our communities, we really stick to Shkia. Those who have different traditions, you know, can consult their Rabbanim about that. But the Psak that I've been brought up with is that Hefsek Tara must be done before Shkia. Hefsek Tara really should be done later in the afternoon. The Poskim prefer that Hefsek Tara be done later in the afternoon, as close to Shkia as possible. Not literally on the buzzer, but should be approximately a little bit of time before Shkia. Because the later it is, the closer it is, the greater proof, so to speak, that we're on the right track, that the bleeding is really stopping and we're ready to start the Shiva Nekiyim. But the Eved, even if a Hefsek Tara was done earlier in the day, that would be acceptable. And many Rabbanim recommend, that there's a common issue with Zman Hazeh, many of our wives work, and sometimes, you know, especially in the wintertime, you know, Shkia could be at 4:30, and 4:20 for her to go run through Hefsek Tara in the middle of a meeting is not always so practical. So many Rabbanim will recommend that a woman do almost a backup Hefsek Tara in the morning. Before she goes to work in the morning, if she senses that she's going to have ready to do Hefsek Tara, let her do it at 8 o'clock in the morning. That way she'll know that the Hefsek Tara is okay. If she's able to do a later one, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, because l'chatchila, you should do it late in the afternoon. Not tough, great, wonderful. If for whatever reason she got stuck on the train, so she doesn't have to have a panic attack, that she has to go run out to go do Hefsek Tara, she'll always know in her back pocket that she has Hefsek Tara to rely on. So it's probably not a bad eitzah that, again, those women who are out of the house in the afternoons, it's probably a good thing to take a little bit of the stress off, that at least they know that the Hefsek Tara from the morning is good, assuming that it is. Very often, it will take later in the day for her to actually get a clean Hefsek Tara, and again, she would have to wait and see for that. So the absolute critical is that the woman performs the Hefsek Tara before sunset, and then in addition to the Hefsek Tara, there is a minhag Yisrael that a woman does something in addition. It's almost like a super-duper Hefsek Tara. It's what's called a moch. A moch means she takes one of these bedikah klotz again. These bedikah klotz are easily attainable. You get them usually buy them in the mikvah. You take a little, just as an aside, if a woman happens not to have one of these bedikah klotz, so you can do like the old style way, like everyone used to do in the old days. You take a shmat, you take an old t-shirt or something, and you just cut a little small square, and that becomes a bedikah cloth. And so you take either a real bedikah cloth or a makeshift bedikah cloth, and after doing a hefsek tara is that she goes in all around and she makes sure that it's clean. Then she takes another bedikah cloth and she actually inserts it into that area and she leaves it there for the period of Ben HaShemashos. Ben HaShemashos is the time between when the sun sets and the stars come out, and then she takes it out afterwards and looks at it, and hopefully if it's clean. So that's, again, that's the added Chumrah version of Hefsek Tara called the Moch. It is customary to do a Moch. It's not absolutely necessary. Shulchan Aruch quotes, it's an old custom to do it. So women should be instructed to try to do it, but there are some women who have difficulty doing it. Some women get irritated by it. If a woman is having difficulty performing a moch properly, she should contact the Rav, and again, depending case by case, very often the Rav will say, if it's causing sometimes more problems than it's accomplishing, so very often the Rav will tell her to forego doing the moch. Foregoing Hefsek Tara is not a discussion, but the moch, since it's a chumrah, it's a minug, so it should be by case by case. Again, the starting point is that she should do it. That's says in Shulchan Aruch. It's an old custom from the Rishonim. It's based on the Gemara, a little bit based on the Gemara, to do a moch. But there may be certain grounds where Rabbanu will be a little bit more lenient for a woman in terms of doing a moch.
How long did it take?
So the moch is supposed to be in for Ben HaShemashos. This is also a tricky Zman HaYom question. How long do you think Ben HaShemashos is? So the tradition that I have is that since the moch is not an absolute halacha anyway, we have a right to be very, very lenient on how long Ben HaShemashos is. So we have a right to be lenient that Ben HaShemashos is approximately 25 minutes. So I think it may even be a little bit shorter in Boston because it's a little bit dropped further north. At least that's what my GPS was pointing northeast or so as I was going here. So it's a little bit, maybe a little bit longer, I'm sorry, a little bit longer in Ben HaShemashos than Boston. The further south you are, it gets a little bit shorter. If you're in Florida, you get a very short Ben HaShemashos. I would say about 25 minutes or so is enough for this. Even though we wouldn't do Malachim on Shabbos at 25 minutes, but for this thing, which is not even a Derabban, it's more of a Chumra, Midas Chasidus, that the Rishonim quote, so I think for 20, 25 minutes or so should be sufficient. And there are other Rabbanim who say, whatever your standard is for Matzah Shabbos, that's a long, you have to keep the Mochin, that's a long standard. So I find that if you tell women that, it's Chumra Mevel Dekula, because then they're going to tell, I can't keep it in for an hour and a half anyway, so I might as well not do it altogether. So if you tell them 20, 25 minutes or so, that's probably good enough for the purpose of this. After she takes out either the Hefsek Tara or the Moch, there may be a shaila on it. There may be something on the B'dikah cloth that may be questionable, which has to be looked at by a Rav. Once we're dealing with something on a bedika cloth, either through a moch or a hefsitar or bedikas, as we're going to talk about in a moment, so then everything we spoke about before about ksamim just fell by the wayside. There are no leniencies on bedika cloths for a variety of reasons. Even if it's a very, very small spot, that's a problem. I can have a color bedika cloth. Some of the clues before are not going to be relevant. But the bottom line is even the smallest amount of a problematic color is going to be a problem. But that's the key. It has to be a problematic color. If it's a color that's permissible up yalocha, then it's permissible technically on a bedikah cloth as well. And this becomes very, very tricky. And again, going back to what we spoke about before, here a Rav has to look at a bedikah cloth in a certain sense even more carefully than a kesem. If he's looking at a kesem, so he always has in the back of his mind, well, if it's not more than a gris, I'm okay anyway. So he's going to look at it through one set of eyes. If he's looking at a bedikah cloth, he's looking for the smallest thing. And sometimes a color on a bedikah cloth could look all right to somebody who doesn't have the training, and the Rav will look at him, will notice that there is a little bit of... Thank you so much. I appreciate it. The Rav will notice that there is a little bit of a discoloration, and then you have to look very carefully to see, is it something that falls into the category of red or not? Some of the very common shallows on bedikah cloths are, sometimes the stain itself on the bedikah cloth will be a yellowish, brownish, which... depending on what your standards are, yellow and brown, that's a really different question. But if you look a little bit carefully, you'll notice that on the edges, sometimes there's a little bit of a red, almost a red tint to, and that's something that a Rav will have to look at very, very carefully to see, is that a problematic color or not. And sometimes when you send a shayla, particularly on a bedikah cloth, if you send a shayla to be looked at, so you may get somewhat of a frustrating answer. The Rav will say, well, I can't look at it now, I'll call you back tomorrow. So you're a little taken aback. Then you can't look at it now. I'm paying your salary, you don't look at that. So the answer is, because it's not sunny out. And the din is that if it's something which is an absolute clear-cut shayla, so many rabbanim will look at even in electric lights. But if it's something that needs a little bit of yeshiva das, a little bit of careful look at, so then they will look at it in the daylight. There are some rabbanim who have these lamps, you know, these special daylight mimicking lamps. I had one at one time. I never really was too excited about it. The only reason why I stopped using it was a little bit of a lazy reason. But before I was the Rav in Bergenfield, I used to be a Rav in Paramus, New Jersey. And my closet at the time was much lower. So I was able to just, every time I needed, it was just a bunch of bulb. I would just unplug my regular bulb and plug that in. We moved to Bergenfield, so then my closet was higher. So it means I had to go get a chair to start climbing up. So it became a whole nimtza chumra kula. So it became such a hassle every time I wanted to use it. So then I convinced myself it wasn't helping anyway. So I'm not so sure that it helps so much. Again, some rabbanim love it. And some rabbanim aren't so excited about it. So again, different ways. The best way to look at a shayla is to look at it in the sunlight. And again, the Rav is trained to how to look at a position in the sun properly to try to get a good vision. Sometimes you can have a problem when you have a shayla and you can't give an answer right away. It's not sunny out. You can go days and days and days without getting the proper sunlight. So it's a little bit tricky. You know, I don't like to do this, but I'm always weary to send some and send maris and send bedikah cloths in the mail to somebody, because I've had some bad stories with a guy, and someone was waiting to go to the mikvah, and their shayla was rerouted to Texas or something, and he was sitting and waiting in some UPS truck somewhere to get it. So I'm a little bit weary about that, but sometimes you're stuck. I was once used to spend the summers in California years ago, and then somebody called me from New York, and they needed a shayla. The weather forecast was supposed to be raining for the next week, so I told them to send me the shayla, so UPS me the shayla to look at. So sometimes you have to be a little innovative and creative to get the right weather forecast. I remember once I was looking at a shayla, it was right before Shkia. I was in the Old City, and somebody came to show me a shayla. And you know, the Old City, it's not so easy it's hard to see the sun towards the end, because everything's so crowded with all the houses there. So somebody told me, if you go climb on top of that house on the roof, so you'll be able to get the last glimmer of rays of the sun. So as I climbed up on the top of someone in the row, falling off the top of somebody's house, and trying to position myself properly to get a little bit of the sun. And I'm looking at it, it was a tough shot. It was a very close call, Shaila. I picked my eyes up, and I was staring a little at the Harbias. Mamish, I had like a view straight right at the Harbias. I started to shake. So I said to the person, in Tinek, I would have been making the shayla. I said, it was very close. I thought it was mutar. I can't. Mara hadim, mara mikdash. It's a new chum and new chasnida. When you pass the shayla, it's a mikdash.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
I'm not comfortable with the sending of Shilas over pictures because it's very, very hard to get a really, really accurate color. I did answer not that long ago. I gave in one time, and I did answer a shayla v'chasnida over a picture, but it wasn't really a shayla of color. It was more of a shayla of a tipe tipin where they really connect. I forgot about it with the nuance. It was something that I felt I was comfortable enough to be able to see, to really look at a color properly over a phone or a computer or something. I would be very, very weary to do. I know people have been hacking to try to get Rabbanim to do that, make it a little bit easier for people, but I'm personally not yet comfortable. I'm having enough trouble looking at things and looking at it in the sun, Kavu Chaimit to look at it, but it's maybe if the colors will get better, people will be traveling more, maybe we may end up have to work at that. I don't know, I'm not sure, we'll see. So again, so the woman has getting herself ready to begin into the time of Shiva Nikiyim. So she's done her Hefsek Tara, and she's done her Moch, if she was able to. And now she's officially ready to begin counting Shiva's Yom V'Yachatitav. Tara Mizov V'Safala Shiva's Yom. So she has to do what's called the Sfira Shiva Nikiyim. What exactly does she have to do for these Shiva Nikiyim? What do the words mean? So first and foremost, she can't have any blood. If she starts having halachic blood, either she starts to get real period again, or she starts a lot of flow, or she finds a kesem that's a problem. So that's what's called the stira, that sosa, that uproots the Shiva Nikiyim, the whole Shiva Nikiyim are over, and you have to start all over again. She would have to make a new Hefsek Tara and start again to count. So the first, most important thing to be aware of is that if anything goes wrong in Shiva Nikiyim, that's going to ruin it, that's going to mess up the entire Shiva Nikiyim to begin all over again. Does she have to do anything else during Shiva Nikiyim? So the Torah says, V'safra lo Shiva's Yomim. So there's a question in the poskim, what exactly does V'safra mean? Does she have to count? Like Sfiras Omer, like Hini Mucham Zuman, Hayom Yom Rishon the Shiva Nikiyim. So there was such a suggestion that was given by the Shlach HaKadosh, literally the Heilige Shlach, I guess the best way to translate it. The Heilige Shlach, he had a Chiddush Gadol that you have to actually count, you have to count the days, Yom Yom Rishon, Yom Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi. So that was a tremendous Chiddush. Most women, I don't think any women do that today. The Ned Behuda writes in the Tshuva that he said the Shlach was such a Kadosh, it was such an Oyev Mitzvahs. The Gemara says, Oyev Mitzvahs lo yisba Mitzvahs. If a person loves mitzvahs, they can never get enough of mitzvahs. They're always running after mitzvahs. So the Rebbe writes with a smile. He says, the Shlomo is such a heilig tzaddik that he needed an extra mitzvah. A 614th mitzvah to count. He said, no, we never heard of such a mitzvah. There's no such mitzvah. There's no mitzvah to formally, to verbally count. So we assume that that's not what v'safra means. What does a woman have to do during Shiva Nikiyim? So the Mishnah says in the Enemus HaChaznida that she has to check herself. She has to do what's called bedikos. She has to, going back to the bedikah clothes again, she has to check herself during the course of the Shiva Nikiyim to make sure that she is in fact not bleeding. How many times does she have to check herself? So the simple reading of the Mishnah is that she's supposed to check herself every day. How many times a day? So there was a machlekes in the Rishonim, and Shulchan Aruch quotes the opinion that one should try l'chetchila to check herself twice a day. She should check herself once in the morning and once later in the afternoon. That's the way the Shulchan Aruch quotes. Nevertheless, later poskim say that if you have a woman who's having difficulty, sometimes a woman doing a lot of bedikas causes irritation. So the poskim say that, again, this is a case by case. So some poskim will say that maybe she doesn't have to do two bedikas a day, maybe she doesn't have to check every day. Again, this becomes really, really case by case when we're willing to forego some of the lechatchila ways of doing the bedikas. But again, every day she should for sure be doing bedikas, at least the starting point. Those who follow, it says explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch, should be doing two bedikas a day. Those who are having issues, and those who spoke to Rabbanim about having potential issues, may find themselves doing a little bit less than those absolute numbers of bedikas. But some bedikas have to be done. That everybody agrees. The Shulchan Aruch quotes a major dispute in the Gemara and the Rishonim about what's the absolute bare minimum. If she didn't do these bedikas, she cannot go to the mikvah. So one opinion is that as long as she did one bedikah, any time, bare minimum, one time during the whole week, she did one bedikah somewhere, anywhere, so then that's good bedieved, and that's considered to be Shiva Nikiyim. Then the Shulchan Aruch quotes another view that says, no, she has to have at least one on day one and one on day seven. She missed a couple of days in between, that's okay, but she has to have the bookend, she has to have day one and day seven, that's not negotiable. How do we paskin halacha in that shayla? So Shulchan Aruch is machmer in that shayla. Therefore, even if we tell women to cut down something as a bedikas because of irritations and other reasons, but we're almost never going to tell them to cut down on 1 and 7. 1 and 7 is very, very significant. Sometimes a woman forgets in between. You know, she's supposed to be doing it every day. She forgot this, she forgot that. So again, as long as she had the 1 and 7, we'll be all right. If she forgot 1 in 7, so then she really, really has to ask Shaila. Very, very tricky if and when she can even go to the mikvah altogether if she forgot the 1 in 7. Sometimes you have a situation where a woman may have forgotten, let's say day 7, there's a common Shaila. A woman comes to the mikvah, she's all ready to go to Tovel, and then she, oh my goodness, I forgot to do bedikah today. Now it's too late, it's already dark. So now what does she do? So the Rabbi Yehuda writes that, well, she's done bedikas all along. So she did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. She forgot 7. So no big deal. She goes home and comes back the next night. Namely, she does a bedikah tomorrow. So basically what she did was, she just called day 2, day 1, and day 8 just became day 7. So simple math, she just pushed herself off by a day. So if that's all that happened, that's not the end of the world. But unfortunately, sometimes happens, and if a woman has a specific heter to only do 1 in 7, which has to be sanctioned by a rav, if a woman has a heter to only do 1 in 7, then it is absolutely critical that she remembers to do that 7th day bedikah. Because if she forgets to do that 7th day bedikah, then she doesn't have anything else back to rely on, and then it's going to be a serious shaila whether she can even go to the mikveh at all. She may have to wait a whole other week of Shiva Nikiyam. So I say this anytime I tell a woman that she's permitted to do the 1 in 7, which again is only case by case, I reiterate to them that they must remember to do that 7th day bedikah, not to call me an hour after shkia in the mikveh that they forgot to do the 7th day bedikah, because that's going to become very, very problematic. I have gotten too many of those calls. That's why I try to remind them that they should. Some rabbanim will tell the women to do in between bedikas possibly, and again this gets more of a case by case basis. But the general rule is she should be doing bedikas every day of Shiva Nikiyam, as instructed by whatever her rabbi is telling her. But the bare minimum should be 1 in 7. Anything less than that is treading on a potential very, very serious shaila.
1 in 7, one time each day.
That's the bare minimum bedi'evet, right? Bedi'evet, that would be that according to all days in Shulchan Aruch, that would be acceptable at least bedi'evet. In addition to doing active bedikas or according to the Shulah counting, other things, so there's something else that she's supposed to be doing during Shiva Nikiyam, and that she's supposed to be wearing levanim. She's supposed to be wearing white during Shiva Nikiyam. The wearing of white is not an absolute halacha. I don't mean to say that she doesn't have to do it. I mean she definitely should be doing it, but according to most poskim, it's v'taras minog. It's a minog that should be observed under normal circumstances. What I mean by normal circumstances, every once in a while you'll have a woman who's having difficulty. She's having strange kinds of spotting, and the Rav may be willing to be makil to let her do to wear tzivonim, to wear colored during Shiva Nikiyam. So again, that's also a case-by-case basis. But the starting point is that the woman is wearing levanim during Shiva Nikiyam, which, again, it's a minig that should be observed. It's the proper minig Yisrael to be observed, unless there's some yotzim in a cloud that has to be addressed on a case-by-case basis. After all of this happens, after she did her Hefzik Tara and she did her Moch, she was able to, and she counted her Shiva Nikiyam and everything passed and everything was wonderful, Vivaldik, so then if all went Keseder, she should be ready to go to the mikvah. But sometimes you have a situation where everything went Keseder, maybe. Namely, she had a Shiloh somewhere along the way. Either she had a Shiloh on a Bedikah cloth on day 3, or she found the Kesem on day 5. And she's in China. She's nowhere near a Rav. And somehow the computer's not working well. We can't get an answer. We have no idea. Is she Muteris? Is she Asur? Can she go to the mikvah? Not go to the mikvah? What's her status? So she should be in contact with the Rav, who will tell her, in effect, to almost, in effect, keep like 2 counts. So let's expect the yom a little bit. Like, we're not really sure what day you're up to be determined. So she's on vacation. She's going to come back. So when she comes back, all ready to go to the mikvah, we're going to look at the shayla. So we may let her go to the mikvah tonight. We may tell her, well, you can't go to the mikvah yet because you really had to start all over again, and now you're on you're only up to day 5. So you can have a woman who's not, she knows she's in Shiva Nikiyam, but she's not quite sure, she's not sure which day of Shiva Nikiyam she's up to. That's okay, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. To be determined. Obviously, she can't go to the mikvah until it's determined properly. So she can be walking this tightrope of having almost two counts that eventually will be decided. What she should not do, some women make this mistake, is that, let's say a woman finds a shayla, so she says, forget it, I'm sure it's usher. And she throws out, I'm sure it's usher. And then the husband comes home and she says, I'm sure it's usher. I said, maybe not, maybe. Let's look at it. You know, it's not as bad as we think. Let's bring it to a rav. So some poskim have a chumra now that even if the rav says that it's mutter, the fact that she gave up hope of being in Shiva Nikiyam, that may gufa undo the Shiva Nikiyam. So she may have really goofed. The bedik itself may be mutter. The kesem may be paskin to be, it's not really red. Everything is mutter, but her giving up hope may have caused the problem. Not everyone agrees to that. There are different shittas about that. But to avoid that shiloh, a woman should always get into the habit of, The Rav who I learned by told me the following three words: never say die, or it ain't over till it's over. I think a Yogi Berra, I don't know who was official quote that. It's not usher until the Rav paskens it's usher. You think it's usher, maybe it's usher. Get it? If it's not a shaila, a woman finds mamish red and bright red on her bdika cloth, and she has no pliyas or nothing, so you don't have to bring that to a Rav. But if there's any mashu, any suffix, any ladies of suffix, so don't decide on your own. Bein l'kula, bein l'chumra. The kula obviously don't decide, even the chumra don't decide on your own. Bring it to a Rav, and to be determined. So as long as in the back of your mind, you still may be in Shiva Nikiyam, that's not called the breaking up of the Shiva Nikiyam. So after all of this passed, either she became a Nida D'Araisa, or she became a Nida through Ksama, whatever the case was, she did her Hefzik Tara, she did her Moch, she did her Shiva Nikiyam, and she's ready to go to the Mikvah. So we're going to take a break now, whatever in between, and then hopefully in a few minutes, we'll continue from that point in terms of going to the Mikvah and some of the other things that come up in terms of Chassidim as well.
Are all these on? Or were they still on?
Are these back on? Okay. So the thing where we left off, just before we actually begin, so I was asked to try to hold off the questions. We'll take some time, about 11:45 or so, the last 15 minutes, so we'll try to take all the questions together. So we'll try to speak straight until then, and then we'll something's up at the end. So we left off where the woman had just finished everything, our sikhtaras, and mokhs, and the deek, everything, she's ready to go to the mikvah. So when we speak about the woman going to the mikvah, the Gemara actually has a machlokas, what we call tevila bizmana mitzvah, tevila bizmana ain't a mitzvah. Is a woman absolutely required by the halacha to go to the mikvah on that night? Or let's say she doesn't want to, she wants to wait a couple of days, so she permitted to delay the going to the mikvah. So technically speaking, we paskin tefillah bizmana ain't a mitzvah, but not practically speaking, from the following sense, that tefillah bizmana me'ikar din is ain't a mitzvah. That means that she's hilchos tefillah proper doesn't require her to go that night. If she wanted to dray and go a couple of nights later, that would be okay. But the Rishonim are quick to point out that there are other factors that do insist that she goes to the mikvah on time. Those factors are, for Ravu, even if she already has a boy and a girl, the mitzvahs of having more children. So clearly for the purposes of getting her to become Tahora as soon as possible, it is strongly, strongly encouraged that she should go to the mikvah at the earliest possible time. Even if, for whatever reason, she's not going to become pregnant that month, let's say, again, this obviously she would have to have a heter to be on birth control, but even a woman who does have a heter to be on birth control and she's not going to become pregnant at that time, it's still strongly, strongly recommended that she try to go to the mikvah at the earliest time possible. It's not as chomer as if she's really trying to have a child, in the following sense, that if the couple is really trying to have a child, hopefully trying to have a child, so then even if it becomes a little bit of a tircha, a little bit of a hassle, and even if the husband and the wife both agree that it's better to wait a night or two, she should not do that. She should make the extra effort, unless if it's impossible. It's impossible. But she should make the extra effort to go to the mikvah on time to enhance her possibilities of becoming pregnant. If she's not going to become pregnant that month, and even though we would prefer that she becomes tahor as soon as possible, but if it's difficult for her and both husband and wife agree, both mochel, both consent, so then they would be permitted, so to speak, there's no isser to push off going to the mikvah. Not recommended, not a good idea, but then there's no absolute halachic imperative to go to the mikvah at the earliest time. But again, in the normal circumstances, we insist that the woman does go to the mikvah at the earliest possible time. What if the husband's out of town? Oh, she's out of town, he's out of town, they're not going to be together anyway, so then the Ikra Din, there's really no reason for her to go to the mikvah that night. Should she go to the mikvah that night anyway? So there are different customs about this. There are those who have a certain practice, again, this is a little more prevalent in many of the Chassidic communities, that a woman doesn't go to the mikvah if the husband's not around. Those who don't have that practice are not obligated to adopt that practice. And the regular, in the Shulchan Aruch, that custom is not quoted, that according to the basic halacha, so she would be permitted to go to the mikvah if the husband's not around. Usually what I tell women to do is whatever works out better for them. So if it's practical, it's easier for them to go that night, even though the husband's not around, unless, again, if they have that particular tradition from those those traditions, that's a different story. But those who don't have that practice, so then whatever works better, if it works better to go tonight, the next night, whatever works out in terms of practicality. But under normal circumstances, she should be encouraged to go to the mikvah at the right time. When we speak about going to the mikveh at the right time, that's even if the right time happens to fall out on a Friday night or a Yontif night. Now, I know this sometimes becomes logistically difficult, depending how close the mikveh is. Again, if it's impossible, it's impossible. But if it's possible, so then the woman should be encouraged to go to the mikveh on Friday night as well, on Yontif night as well. Sometimes it becomes difficult in terms of it can be possibly embarrassing and people are going to find out. Obviously, in Hilchos Nida, we try to do everything possible to observe Tznius. One is not supposed to share information that they want to mikvah with anybody else unless it's absolutely necessary, such as a mikvah later or a rav. But otherwise, this is clearly something that out of the bounds of Tznius to discuss. But nevertheless, a person is allowed to act in a normal manner. So if a normal manner means going to the mikvah on a Friday night, and if it happens to be that somebody who's staying in your house puts two and two together, so they put two and two together, you're not mechuyev to go crazy, to bend over backwards, to prevent that from happening, and thereby sacrifice to going to the mikvah on time. So once you try, obviously we try to be as tenu as possible about it, but within reason, a person is permitted to do what's normal taras hamishpacha dictates. So a person, a woman is going to the mikvah, hopefully at the right time. When we say the right time, so that means the Shiva Nekiyim are over. What if the Shiva Nekiyim are not technically over? What if it's still Miba'od Yom? What if it's still within the daytime? So this is a very, very tricky thing. Min HaTorah, technically speaking, a woman would be permitted to go to the mikvah even in the morning of Shiva Nekiyim. We would apply what's called in Halacha the principle, either Miktas HaYom Kekulo, part of the day counts as the whole day, or perhaps it's based on a different halachic principle, a little bit of an intricacy in Hilchos Nida. But the bottom line is that min HaTorah, the woman would be permitted to go to the mikvah even Miba'od Yom. However, mid the Rabbanan, she is not allowed to do this. Mid the Rabbanan, she still has to wait until it gets dark. So under normal circumstances, we will never permit a woman to go to the mikvah Miba'od Yom. However, there may be, according to some poskim, again, this is something that must be discussed on a case-by-case basis with a Rav, under certain very, very extenuating circumstances, there may be grounds to permit a woman to go to the mikvah Miba'od Yom. Issues such as danger issues, issues such perhaps if it's a Friday night out of the tchum, other illness issues, whatever the case may be, is a literally a case-by-case basis to possibly permit her going to the mikvah Miba'od Yom, with the understanding that not only is she not going to be with her husband until dark, but she shouldn't even see her husband until dark. If that could be arranged, then a Rav is willing to permit it under certain extenuating circumstances, then there may be something to discuss. I say it may because there are some poskim who don't accept the whole idea. The whole concept doesn't exist, at least on the seventh day. On the eighth day, if a woman didn't go to the mikvah on the right night and now she's pushed off to the following day, then there would be a little bit more grounds to be lenient under certain difficult circumstances to actually permit a tefillah bayom. That already appears in the Gemara itself, but that also has to be discussed case by case. But to permit a tefillah on the seventh day Miba'od Yom is not something that we would permit under normal circumstances, and many, many poskim would never permit it under any circumstances. Something which is absolutely out of the question, and the reason why I'm emphasizing it, I literally just got a shaila about it last week, is that sometimes people, what we call madama milsa la milsa, they start to compare one thing to the next So a woman called me that she was going to be out of town, and it was very complicated where she was going to be, an old story, we're just going to work in a convention, a whole chagadja. And she said the best time for her to go to the mikvah, she wasn't going to see her husband anyway for the next day and a half, the best time for her to go to the mikvah was the night of the seventh. I don't mean the night following the 7 days, I mean the night of the seventh itself. So according to the overwhelming majority of the Rishonim, that could be a potential sakaris, because that's not even called the tefillah of the Yom HaShvi. That's a tefillah balayla of the Yom HaShvi, which we don't even say Miktas Yom Kekulo. I say potentially karis because Shiva Nekiyim, as we said before, I said, I don't want to get into the nuances of that, but I told the woman very, very emphatically that under nobody would ever permit the woman going to the mikvah on the night of the 7th. The day of the 7th, maybe we could discuss, maybe, but the 9th, the night before was clearly out of the question. By the time I finished, she was pushing me a little bit for the day of the 7th. So I said, why can't you go on the night? So she explained to me, she has to go to this, and she's going to drive here, and put in a whole story. It turned out that she could go technically at night. It would have been 2 o'clock in the morning. So I said, okay, then you have to call the mikvah and find out. Some mikvahs will set up a way for you to go to the mikvah. Sometimes you bring your own woman to come with you, whatever. Those are technical details, but how to do that. So again, if a person finds themselves in a very, very unique situation, going to the mikvah all hours of the night, so they have to contact the mikvah, not 2 minutes before, they have to contact the mikvah beforehand to try to make the appropriate accommodations. But the starting point should not be, well, no big deal, we're going to mikvah in the daytime. That's not the correct starting point. If and when that ever comes up, maybe there's something to discuss. before a woman goes to the mikvah, so there are a few basic things that she has to be aware of. The Gemara tells us there are halacha moshe mesinais that govern what's considered to be a chatzitza, what's considered to be a separation, a barrier on a body that could potentially disqualify the tevila. There are dinim of chatzitza min haTorah, and there are dinim of chatzitza min derabbanan. The way Hilchos Chatzitza plays out today basically boils down to one question. Is it something that the woman cares about? Is it what's called a Davar HaMakpid, or is it not a Davar HaMakpid? The Gemara says that min haTorah, it's only considered to be a chatzitza if it's both on the majority of the body, as well as something that you really care about, you really want to remove. It's called the Rubo HaMakpid. I have never ever gotten a shayla of a Rubo HaMakpid. It would basically mean a woman just went mudsliding and then she wants to go to the mikvah and head to toe in mud. Doesn't happen. All the shaylas b'zman hazeh are what we call a Miur HaMakpid, which are problems with the Rabbana. We take them with the utmost seriousness. It means they're real problems with the Rabbana. Now their eyes says that the Rabbana take problems. So all of the mechatzitza issues that we have b'zman hazeh, no matter what they are, whether it's the stitches, whether it's the nail polish, whether it's they've got to take out the contact lenses, whatever the cast, you name it, chatzitzas b'zman hazeh always end up to be shayles of chatzitzas b'derabanan. So the question that the Rav has to always be aware of, is this something which is a davar hamakbid or not? Davar hamakbid is a tricky term, because the Shulchan Aruch quotes from the Ravid, was the idea from the Mishnah, that makbid doesn't mean what maybe you and I would have thought it meant. Sometimes I have something on my body right now, and I'm really not makbid on it. I'm very happy that it's there. But in a day from now, I'm not going to want it to be there anymore. So that's also considered to be makbid. That's what we pask in Shulchan Aruch. Even a makbid liachazman is considered to be a makbid. So because we pask in, like this Ravid in Shulchan Aruch, that even a hakpada liachazman is a problem. So that opens up a lot of serious shaylas about a lot of medical potential chatzitzas. You know, we're not going to go through every detailed shahs right now, just to familiarize ourselves, just the basic rules are, not so much to be able to paskin the shayla per se, but just to be aware of what has to be asked. The bottom line is, everything that looks strange has to be asked. If a woman knows that she has stitches, and she knows she has in the middle of having dental work done, and she knows she's wearing a cast, and she knows she's got this problem, that, all these medical things connect with our body, so the last thing we would want is for her to come to the mikvah and have them turn her away. The shayla should be presented to the rabbi before. And I once had a very, very unfortunate, it was one of the most unfortunate shaylas that I had to deal with in terms of hilchos tefillah b'mikvah. A woman had been in an accident for a while. She hadn't gone to the mikvah in a long time. And she was in between, I forgot, it was years ago, it was in between something on her leg with a cast or something else. It was back and forth. And she apparently drove for a long way. She was not from our community. She drove from far away, Dafka to our mikvah, because it has the handicapped lift, so she thought it would be easier for her. But it was such a blatant chatzitza, shayla. It was such a serious shayla that I could not be makel. I didn't think there was any real tzad to be makel in the shayla. She was very, very upset. I mean, rightfully so, she was upset. But she was very upset because here, you know, she was in effect saying, well, I traveled for an hour to come here. Obviously, Rav has to be sensitive, but she should have asked before. Coming to the mikvah with something as blatant as that was, so that's obviously something that you have to assume may be a problem. So women should be instructed that if there's something, anything out of the ordinary, they have to ask a shayla before, and the last thing you want to do is to start getting into an argument at the mikvah about it. So again, so if it's something that's a davar hamakpid, that could be a problem. There are different opinions in the poskim about some of the things that I mentioned before, about stitches is a very, very common shayla. Is stitches considered to be a davar hamakpid or not? So there are those who suggest that maybe stitches is not such a davar hamakpid, even though we said before that even something that you eventually want to be taken out is called a davar hamakpid. But what if there's a very, very set amount of time? It means it's not that I want to take it out in the next 5 minutes. I really want this to be in for 2 weeks, because the doctor refused to take it out medically for 2 weeks. So there are poskim more lenient than that. When you have something which is there medical reasons and it's there for a very set amount of time and it would be to our disadvantage to remove it earlier, there are some poskim more makel on that. Not everyone's makel on that, and there are different opinions. There are some who say it depends how long the stitches are in, and then within those opinions, you have a further breakdown, how long is long, array across the possibilities. So I don't want to give any clear-cut psak here. There are different standards, different rabbanim have different traditions as to exactly these issues relating to stitches.
Dental stuff is
pretty much the same thing. Dental may sometimes a little bit more makel, because based on starting we're a little bit more makel on, but dental issues could potentially be part of the same story. a lot of the temporary stuff in the mouth, there may be other grounds to be made. Moshe is another tzad l'hakel, that if you have, let's say, a temporary filling, but it's going to become a permanent filling, so maybe that's called an enamak, because they know forever and ever that tooth's going to be filled up. So that's also like, even though I don't want the temporary filling in forever, but I do want something there forever, so maybe that's called an enamak. But again, I don't want to give an absolute psak on these cases. These are really cases that have to be determined, and the standards in different mikvahs are a little bit different sometimes. There are different opinions in poskim about these things. A very complicated issue is the issue of the cast. So a woman comes to the mikveh with the cast, so even though there could be certain grounds to be make on the cast, based on what we said before, if you make on the stitches, so the cast is not that different, she needs the cast to be on for the next 6 weeks, and she really doesn't want it to be taken off. So one could argue the cast is not considered to be a chatzitza. The problem is that many of the casts can't get wet. So she's in a catch 22. So she would have to put a bag over the cast. But the problem is, most women don't like walking around the street with a bag on them. So a bag is called the davar machbid right away. So the cast may be not so terrible, but the bag on top of the cast is going to be a big, big problem. So it could become tricky. Some women, some people have this idea that no problem, they'll convince the doctor to take the cast off and then put the cast back on, and good luck. I have never ever had any doctor who's willing to do that. The last thing a doctor wants to get is sued for he'll take the cast off the woman with triple the mikveh, and someone's going to try to figure out in court why she was going with a broken leg into the mikveh. So again, I haven't had too much good experience in trying to get that done, so I wouldn't try that either. Is it serious shaila? Is it serious shaila? Anything that's on medically can potentially be a serious shaila. One shouldn't give up hope. One shouldn't assume, well, it's automatically ulcer. There was a case that we were dealing with not that long ago, a very complicated child. It was a fairly young woman who had a very serious medical condition, and she had to have a certain device connected to her all the time, and that device couldn't get wet. And it was a very tricky child. We had to come, spoke to another gadol to really, really come up with an etza, how to get around that. So a woman shouldn't just automatically discount and say, everything's going to be ulcer, I can't go to mikveh for the next 5 years, but it's tricky and it has to be looked at before, and not something that should be decided at the mikveh itself. Some of the easier things that are the common chatzitzas, we'll just throw the Rashi Prakim, some of the common chatzitzas to be aware of. The Mishnah speaks about jewelry being a chatzitza. That was actually the Ravid's Raya. The Ravid says, why is jewelry a chatzitza? The woman's very happy that she's wearing the jewelry. So the Ravid says, well, when she needs the dough for the bread tomorrow, she's going to take her rings off. So that's called the Davra Makbid. So even though right now she's okay with it on, but she may need dough at any given moment, so that's called the Davra Makbid. So the Mishnah says that if the ring, the jewelry is loose, so the water gets right under it, that's not considered to be a chatzitza. So we have the shayla, a very, very common shayla. A woman comes to the mikvah and she can't get her ring off. So your initial reaction is, you can't get the ring off, it must be that it's tight, so it's a problem. No, not necessarily. Sometimes the ring is not tight, her knuckle swells. Often after pregnancy, the knuckle of fingers will swell a little bit. She can't get it over the hump. So the ring is really loose. If you can move the ring around, the water gets right under the ring, but lemaisa, you can't get it over the knuckle. So the post can make on that. Again, normally we insist on taking off all jewelry, but if she really, really can't get the ring off, not because it's stuck tight to the finger, but it just can't go over the hump of the knuckle, so then we can be makeling that. I've done that in the past. At one time I had to get a woman, Mamash literally had to break the ring. She wasn't happy about it, but she had to get, it was my luck that I think there was someone in her family who was a jeweler who was willing to do it for her, like in the middle of the night or something, so it was a little bit of a mikdash nechama. Right, so that's what Ramosha quotes from the Zichron Yos, where Ramosha interprets this pasuk to say, is that if it's something which any moment she could start to need dough, that's called a davar machbid. But if there's a set amount of time, I'm not taking these stitches out for another week, because chuk lo yavar, so maybe that's called not a davar machbid. Even according to those who are lenient a little bit by stitches, is that would only be true if the stitches are still functioning medically. Very often you have a case where the stitches are ready to come out. If the doctor's on vacation, doctor's not coming back till tomorrow. So that's a problem. I remember once I had a woman who she had dental work, and the dentist said, I can take him out on Thursday, but I'm going to be out of town on Thursday. And she was supposed to go to the mikvah on Friday night. And the dentist said, well, I'm not going to be back till Monday. Come back on Monday. But I said, you can't go to mikvah like that. I said, the stitches are ready to come out. They're not doing anything anymore. You can't rely on Ramosha for that. If the stitches are already done, medically they're finished, so then the royal lekach to come out at moment's notice. So she had to go to another dentist to get the stitches out in order to enable her to go to the mikvah. Today, very often...
The fact that a woman never needs dough and ever is not going
to make it. Women wash. They still they wash dishes. Some women still wash dishes. Somebody washed the dishes. I don't wash the dishes. Somebody washed. that line should be scratched from. She didn't send me at 4 o'clock in the morning to Boston to announce I don't wash the dishes. Okay, getting back to this story. Going back to the stitches could also become a little different if they're dissolvable stitches. That's really a whole another part of the ballgame. So again, we're not going to pass in specific shilas. These are things to be aware of. Let's try just to keep the... We're going to hold off the questions if we want to try to finish everything before 11:45. There is a whole discussion already in the Rishonim, in the Shulchan Aruch, about all kind of issues of makeup. How much is considered to be a Davar Mach, but not Davar Mach when there's a makeup. The bottom line is that she should remove all makeup. Everything should be taken off, including all nail polish. The woman should not be going to the mikveh with any nail polish on. If every once in a while she has a little bit of nail polish that she realizes afterwards, this is very common, the woman she'll come back an hour later and she'll go, "Gavalt, I found a little speck of a little clear nail polish or something." So I ask one question. My question is, if you were on your way to a wedding right now and you discovered this phenomena, would you stop everything and start pulling it off? Or you would say, "Like, I don't even see it. Give me a break. Nobody cares. And I don't care." That's called the Davar Sheina Machpid. And then, with the Eved, that's all right. L'chatchila, the Ramah writes that we have a custom, you should take everything off. You shouldn't start playing around. Is it a Yad Machpid, no Machpid? But with the Eved, she already went to the mikveh. We're not sending women back to the mikveh because of a little mashu of a nail polish that nobody could see. When we speak about nails, that's a whole issue in and of itself in terms of going to the mikvah. So the Mishnah, the Tosefta, have a whole discussion about dirt under nails, when that poses the problem of a chatzitza and when not. To avoid any complications of anything, there's an age-old practice that it was age-old and it still is age-old and it should still be continued, that women should be cutting the nails before they go to the mikvah. There are actually two reasons for that custom. One is to avoid any dirt under the nails. And the other is that if the nails are fairly long and they're actually ready to be cut, and she doesn't cut them, there's one opinion in the Rishonim that says that the nail itself may be a chatzitza. That's a big question whether we really follow that sheet, the Mikra Adin, but there are two good reasons why she should be cutting her nails. Number one, because of any fear of any dirt. And number two, the nail itself shouldn't pose any question whatsoever. So women should be strongly encouraged to cut the nails. However, there's a difference between strongly encouraging and absolutely insisting. The poskim point out that me'ika mikra din, if the nails are clean, so they don't pose a problem. That's the ikra din. Therefore, sometimes you have a phenomenon that a woman comes to the mikvah and she refuses to cut her nails. She's not interested in cutting her nails. So this is not a new shayla of Tashanai and Vav. Reb Chaim Oizer in Vilna, before the war, had to deal with the shayla also. So Reb Chaim Oizer writes that, okay, it's a minhag. It should be a minhag that should be strongly encouraged. But if bottom line is a woman comes to the mikvah and she's not going to do it, if we're going to send her away from the mikveh, so chalil, she may decide not to go to the mikveh that month, so that would be a significantly more mikshol. So we'll look the other way. We'll let her go to the mikveh even with the nails. We should, again, depending on who the woman is, depending on the context, we should try to explain to her. But if we're not accomplishing anything, so it's better to let her go to the mikveh. But again, this is not what we should be advertising. Why we talk about it here, I'm not sure. We should not be telling people this lechatchila, but. We should just be aware. We have to know what's a real chatzitza, what's not necessarily an absolute real chatzitza. The cutting of the nails is considered to be so significant in halacha / minhag that the shach is willing to be makel to have this done by a non-Jew even on Shabbos. If a woman forgot to have her nails cut before going to mikvah, obviously when she goes to the mikvah Friday night or Yom Tov night, she has to cut the nails beforehand. So the shach says that we have a right to rely on Amir Yaakov. If we can ask a non-Jew to cut the nails, the Shach says it's based on the more of a Hilchos Shabbos than a Hilchos Nida Shaila, that cutting of nails, if you're cutting your nails to give you a manicure to make your nails look nice, that's probably a deraisa of gozes, of like shearing sheep, like shearing wool, but removing hair and nails. But if you're not doing it to make it look nice, you're doing it just to get rid of the nails, that probably falls into what's called the Hilchos Shabbos, a malacha shein tzricha legufa. It's a malacha that's not really being done for the same purpose as was done in the Mishkan, or different ways of how to define that properly. But the bottom line is, the Shach says that if you're cutting your nails to go to the mikvah, having a non-Jew cutting for you is probably what we call an Amir Yaakov on a Dirabanan, which is Mutter B'Makom Mitzvah. So the bottom line is that many mikvahs have that set up, that there's many mikvahs have a non-Jewish woman on call, not necessarily in the mikvah itself, but on call, that sometimes when these kinds of things happen last minute Friday night, so a woman has to have nails cut, so we're gonna let them do that. So just to give you an idea as to how serious we do take this minhag. All other kinds of nails, shalos that come up, You know, in some communities, it's a very touchy topic, so I don't want to say anything here. I'm not the Rav here. But suffice it to say that the correct thing to do is follow what it says in Shulchan Aruch, women should be cutting her nails. Those women, for whatever reason, are not going to, and they have all kinds of different nail treatments and fake nails, mice, things like that. So you have to contact the Rav and see what is absolutely, you know, ma'akev in terms of going to the mikvah, and what maybe under certain limited circumstances some rabbanim would be willing to be make a lot. I don't want to give a public policy if it's not my community. Other things in terms of chatzitzas. Chatzitzas apply, the Gemara says, even in the base hastarim, even in areas that are not actually exposed, skin, inside the mouth, there are issues of chatzitza. If a woman has to clean her teeth properly, there are chatzitzas inside the nose area, chatzitzas inside the ear areas, chatzitzas inside the eye areas. Even though the water doesn't necessarily get into these places, you don't have to open your mouth under the water, but there has to be the possibility for the water to get in. In theory, the water could get in. You can't have a davra chatzitz. This is all part of the standard preparation for going to the mikvah, the cleaning of the ears, nose, etc. All the areas, not just on the body itself, but all the areas of beis hastarim, to make sure that there's no issues of any chatzitzas that come up. Which really leads us into the whole general preparation for a woman before she goes to the mikvah. That's what's called chafifa, not to be confused with chatzitza. Chafifa is done to make sure that you don't have a chatzitza. That's the way to remember them. So chafifa means that it's not enough just to take a quick look and say, okay, well, I don't see anything. The Gemara says that minat Torah, that's okay. Minat Torah, you just take a quick head-to-toe look. No, don't see a lot of mud on me. Sounds okay. Go to the mikvah. But the Rabbanon, Ezra, right, this is quite an old takana. Ezra was misakein that before a woman goes to the mikvah, she has to do a chafifa. What exactly is chafifa? So there's a machlekes in the Rishonim where the chafifa of Ezra, the ikra did a chafifa, only involves the hair, because the hair has a lot of potential chatzitzas on it, or whether chafifa involves the entire body. So there are different opinions about this. The halacha doesn't make much of a difference. The halacha, we follow the practice that everything has to be done. From head to toe, the woman has to wash her hair well, just to comb out her hair well, make sure that there are no knots and no dirt, just to wash her body well, the whole chafifa from head to toe, before she would be permitted to go to the mikvah. In no circumstances can a woman go to the mikvah without having done a proper chafifa. If a chafifa was not done, that would even throw into question the validity of the tefillah even after the fact. So chafifa is absolute necessity. How does chafifa practically take place b'zman hazeh? In most of our communities, it involves two primary parts in terms of water. One of them being taking a bath, even though that practice of a woman taking a bath is not an absolute halacha, but it's a minhag Yisrael, at least the minhag in our communities, that should be followed. But a woman takes a bath. How long she takes a bath, that's not halacha mashmah. See how long the bath is, but Ramesha Feinstein, Ramesha is a half hour. That's the minhag Yisrael today, is that we try for a woman to take a bath for a half hour. For whatever reason, she got an emergency phone call, the kids screaming at 28 minutes, she came out, I wouldn't insist on another bath. So, you know, it should be close enough. She should try to aim to get a half hour bath in, and then she has to take a good shower, and most important part is to make sure to do her hair, to comb and brush through all the hair in all areas of the body where there is hair, to be able to be cleaned out properly, to make sure there are no knots and no chatzitz involved. That's the ikra din of chafifa. In addition to the actual bathing part, then she has other things to do, as we said before, to make sure that all the base of star and all the different parts are clean. Usually there's a checklist in the mikvah, go through all the list, just to remind her to make sure that she went through all the things properly to make sure there are no chatzitzas there. One of the other preparations that a woman should do before going to the mikvah is that if she has any hair that she wants to remove, wants to shave her legs, other things of that nature, so that really should be done before going to the mikvah. If she is ready to get hair removed, if for whatever reason she didn't get around to doing it, and now she wants to go to the mikvah, there are some poskim who raise a potential question about that. Because this is a throwback to the nail story. If you have nails that are very long, that are ready to come off, and you didn't take them off, so maybe the nails are a chatzitza, there are some who wanted to extrapolate from that. Now again, that itself is questionable. It's a questionable statement, and it's a questionable extrapolation. So I'm not saying this as an absolute halacha, but I'm saying as a good policy is that the woman should remove any hair that she's planning on getting done. If she's planning on going waxing an hour after she comes back from the mikveh, that's not a good idea. She should do it beforehand. However, particularly when it comes to waxing, it's probably not the best idea to do that right before she goes to the mikveh, because sometimes the wax itself can be more of a chatzitza than the hair was a chatzitza. So chacham ena barosho, or chacham ena barosho, whatever the dictum is, she should try to plan appropriately that any preparation before going to the mikveh that could potentially itself cause chatzitzas is better to be done a little bit before, not to end up causing more problems than was accomplished.
Does that include a haircut?
So a haircut, if she's really, really, really due, like, you know, really super duper due to get a haircut, you know, so then she should probably try to get it beforehand. I'm not sure how and when you can make that statement. Chassam Sofer has a tshuva about the practice that exists and still exists in some of the Hasidic communities, that the women would shave their heads right after the first night. So Chassam Sofer raises the question, is that maybe that'll disqualify the tefillah, because when they go to the mikvah, so they know they're about to shave their hair, so maybe the hair is considered to be a chatzitza. So Chassam Sofer brings a raya from a sugya in Zvochim, that you don't say mechusa maisa, it's a complicated raya, it's rikas adal, you know, to show you why that's okay. When the chassidish women want to shave their heads after the biri shayna, that doesn't pose a problem. But you see from the Chassam Sofer that he held that hair could potentially be a problem. So he was being makel in his tshuva, but from his tshuva you may find that you'd be able to expel him.
Dyed
hair is an issue that should be, a rav has to be addressed about that. If the dyeing looks very, very nice still, then there are more grounds to be made. If the dyeing is not looking so great, that could become potentially more problematic, or almost a case-by-case kind of basis. So yes, these are all part of the regular standard procedures that should take place before she goes to the mikvah. So we have the tefillah itself, we have the chatzitza, we have the chafifas that are done. The chafifas have a specific zman to them. They're supposed to be done shortly before going to the mikvah. There's a machlokes in the Gemara, what does that term mean, shortly before? Is it better to do the chafifa during the daytime, or is it better to do it at night? So the Gemara has reasons for either practice. So one suggestion is it's better to do it in the daytime, because then she'll be less nervous, she'll be more relaxed. At night, it's dark, you know, she's going to be running out herself in the dark and the cold, so she'll be in a rush to get back home, so she won't do as a thorough job. On the other hand, if she does it too early, then she may get dirty again. So the Gemara has back and forth different reasons to defend the practice of doing it in the day or to do it at night. In Shulchan Aruch, the practice that's quoted from the Rishonim is we do a little bit of both. That we recommend a woman to do a little bit of a chafifa, maybe at home late in the day, and then the chafifa should continue into the night, and then then she should go to the mikvah. She can do some of the chafifa at home, some of it in the mikvah, some women like to do it all at home, some like to do it all in the mikvah, again, that's up to the woman. But the preferable way to doing it is to get a little bit by yom, a little bit by night. This is not always so practical, as we said before, a lot of women are working. So in the olden days, the woman wasn't working, so 4 o'clock she could start to do a chafifa. 4 o'clock, she's on stuck in traffic, so she's not going to do a chafifa till later. So b'diavad, any chafifa is good. If it's done either by yom or done by laila, anything is good. Women try to do a little bit of something by yom. Whatever they can, hop around a little bit of something, maybe on yom, so that's the best thing. But all said and done, even a chafifa by laila would be acceptable. When a woman has to go to the mikvah on a Friday night, so then obviously she can't do the chafifa on Friday night itself, so she has to do it maybe on yom. She's going to the mikvah on Motzei Shabbos, so the Ramah quotes a practice that we do almost a double chafifa. She does some of the preparations Friday afternoon, she should get a good thorough cleaning Friday afternoon, and then repeat whatever she can again on Motzei Shabbos. So you get between the two, so you get a good chafifa. When a woman goes to the mikvah on a yontif night, it becomes a little tricky. Let's say if it's a yontif sheni, or a yontif going into Shabbos, Shabbos going to yontif. Whenever a long time has passed since she did a real chafifa, so this gets a little bit tricky, and you have to be on guard for potential chatzitzas, and you have to be especially on guard in terms of the hair. Sometimes a woman's hair gets knotted up. I'm not holding the nuances of this, but apparently sometimes if you have hair in the sheitel for a while, that could potentially cause knotting in the hair. So sometimes you're going to run into a problem. You come into the mikvah on a yontif sheni night, and you have knots in the hair. So what do you do? So we would have to be makel, like the same way the shach was makel to have the non-Jew cut the nails. So many folks would be makel to have the non-Jew brush the hair as well. So especially on a yontif night, a second night yontif, it's probably a good idea. Those mikvahs are able to. We did this actually for some time. We were able to pull this off when we had this couple of 2 years ago. We had all these 3-day yontifs, one after another. You have women coming to the mikvah on Friday night, and they haven't really done their real chafifa since in 48 hours, so you're asking for trouble, so it's probably a good idea to have a non-Jewish woman around who could sometimes help with some odds and ends that have to be done.
Isn't pulling the hair out of secretion?
Yeah, but Amir Yaakov and Pesik Reish is Mikra then okay. Because I'm not asking the non-Jew to do Malach, I'm asking him to come here, which per se is Mutter. It's just it's also because of Pesik Reish.
Isn't that how Pesik Reish is there, Esa? It's called his Kav?
No. First of all, this is a psikreshul nich. It's a question: is this a psikreshul nich? Logically, that's a different question. But it's a mir liyakov. I'm not doing it. I'm asking the non-Jew to brush it here for me. So that's a mir liyakov on a psikresha. Even if a psikreshul nich is the raisa, there's probably no mir liyakov on it. A woman has to also be a little bit thinking ahead before going to the mikvah. The Rishonim quote a minhag that a woman shouldn't eat meat on the day that she's going to the mikvah, because it's going to potentially get stuck in her teeth and may cause problems. It's only b'taras minig, and therefore the poskim write that if it's a sudas mitzvah, so it's going to be mutter. So if a woman's going to the mikvah mitzvah Shabbos, she can eat meat on Shabbos, so she's going to be yontif, she can eat meat. A perm sudas, things that are real bona fide sudas mitzvah, so a woman doesn't have to follow this minig, but she should just be careful to take the thing out afterwards. A couple of years ago, I got a shayla. It was once... This shah was once, and I'm not expecting, according to the calendar, I think for another 18,000 years or something. It was the following shiloh. It was, all of a sudden, it was on Chanukah, and I'm getting a bunch of shilohs of women who want to know, is a sudas Chanukah enough, a sudas mitzvah, to permit eating meat? I think, who has the meat? This is Chanukah. It was the year that the first night of Chanukah, the second night of Chanukah was, the first night of Chanukah was Thanksgiving. It said whatever it was. So women were eating, wanted to eat turkey on Thanksgiving, and they had to go to the mikvah. So they didn't have the chutzpah, the yesbi, as the Sudas Thanksgiving called the Sudas Mitzvah. That's what they were doing. They wanted to know the Sudas Chanukah called the Sudas Mitzvah. So I couldn't find anybody who was... discussing the Shaila, I guess, not from the Shach and Tas talking about Sudas Thanksgiving, so I wasn't sure what Sudas Chanukah, couldn't figure out what the din was. So I said, the Ramah writes that Sudas Chanukah, not really Sudas Mitzvah, let's just sing songs. I thought it was a little bit funny. I said, hold off on the turkey, get extra cranberry sauce, you figure something else to eat. But I didn't think you should eat the turkey before going to mikvah. So I got the 3-4 women caught with the same Shaila, so I think somebody told me that the way the calendar is set up, maybe about a mikdash, so Mashiach will come, we'll go back to Kiddush Beer. And I imagine the most Mashiach Thanksgiving will probably go by the wayside. But maybe, I'm in Boston, I'm afraid to say anything. As I was driving up here this morning, you should know, the only thing I was thinking of, I said, how in the world did they run the Revolutionary War? How in the world did anybody in Boston ever find out what in the world was going on in New York? It's taking me 3.5 hours to drive it by Pony Express. It could take days, weeks, and months for them to find out anything. I just kept on thinking of Paul Revere as I was driving up. Okay, anyway, getting back to Chasnida. So these are a lot of Chafifas and Chatzitzas. Take just a little bit of thinking ahead to make sure we're not going to run into these One last akuda just about tefillah before we talk about a little bit of time left for a couple of other things related to chasnida. About tefillah, it sounds such an obvious thing to say, but not so obvious. One can only go to the mikvah in a body of water that is kosher to be a mikvah. Now, obviously, if it's a kosher mikvah, it's under a reputable, reputable Jewish community, the rabbanim hopefully, will keep you a good eye on the mikvah, that's fine. But if you want to go in a natural body of water, so then that's going to raise a whole series of questions. There's a complicated sugyas in the Dorev and Shabbos about tefillah in rivers. We generally do not tefillah in rivers. It's a general practice. We don't use the rivers as for tefillah, although it's not so poshut that it's a problem. The Ramon, the Tzadeshin, there's a lot of discussion about it, but the basic issue of rivers is that the rivers may very well be rainwater, and if it's rainwater, if it's moving, that's a whole problem in Uchaz Mikvos. So that issue of moving bodies of water could pose problems in terms of potentially lakes. Some lakes are also moving, some lakes have outlets to them, dams to them, it becomes very complicated. The bottom line is, if for whatever reason you find yourself in some strange vacation spot, and don't assume that just because it's a big body of water, so it's okay to be a mikvah. It has to really, really be ascertained properly that this body of water, it could be a very, very small nuance of what is a kosher mikvah, what's a posel mikvah. So one has to be very, very careful. Somebody, I was once called by a group of people going, some families were going, somebody's, it's a national park, somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and they want to know about a certain lake, whether it was kosher. I said, I have no idea. I don't know what the story of this lake is. So they said, well, we'll get you somebody from the park to describe to you where the water's coming from. Is it underground springs? Is it rainwater? Is there a dam? Is there no dam? So they got one of the park rangers on the phone. The guy's trying to explain to me what's going on. And the conversation went like that. So he got a little bit nervous because he wanted to know why I was so interested in the water supply of the park. So he was trying to blow up the park. So the guy there on the other end was trying to explain to him, no, this is a ritual impurity. You can imagine how the conversation went. Okay, anyway, bottom line is, don't assume that just because it looks like water, that's the only kasha to be a mikvah.
Ocean?
I knew someone was going to ask me an ocean. So an ocean, the ikar adin is okay, but an ocean has a lot of logistical problems to it. I really, really encourage people not to use the ocean because there are chatzitza issues, sand gets dirty, and there are tznius issues in the ocean. There are, more important than anything, there are safety issues in the ocean. You know, it's dark, and you go out in the water. It's not a good setup. I understand that if every once in a while a person finds themselves in one of these places, and there's mamish no mikvah around, so then you have to mamish ask a rav how to guide you properly to use an ocean. So ocean is a possibility, but it's logistically not always the best setup. So now that we've pretty much gone through the process of how one becomes a nida and how one becomes no longer a nida, we talk about two other side topics. I mean, they're very much part of Hilchos Nida, as much time that we have. One is the issue of harchakas. When the woman is a nida, what exactly is not permitted to be done? So obviously, having actual relations is the most serious of all the Isurim. That's a clear-cut Isur deraisa with an Isur kares. So obviously, we're not even going to spend time talking about that. But there are other things that are prohibited in the halacha that some of them are asim in HaTorah possibly, some of them are asim in the Rabbanim, some of them are asim in Torah's Minog, that all fall under the general heading, what's called harchokas, harchik, rachok, to stay away, as a siyag, to prevent us from violating Yisurin Hidah. Some of the, what we call harchokas, so to speak, are potentially midaraisa, at least according to many opinions, the way we seem to paskin the halacha, the shach paskins this way, the ram shua paskins this way, that any physical contact when a woman is in nida, if it's done derechiba, if it's done in an affectionate manner, so that's an outright issa min haTorah. It's not an issa kares, not literally having relations, but it's an issa min haTorah. So that would include any kind of kissing, hugging, holding hands, anything of that nature. So is anything that's called derechiba is absolutely out of the question. Under no circumstances, according to many, many Rishonim, the way we generally assume the halacha, that's a violation. The pasuk in Chumash lo sikur v'legalas erva, dvar ma'mevim l'degil erayus. That's absolutely off limits. However, the Gemara tells us that even things that are called shloba derechiba, even touching not in an affectionate manner, is also a problematic, albeit midirabana. Therefore, a couple has to be careful. Not, I mean, if it happens by mistake, it happens, but a couple should try really to be careful not to touch in any shape or form when the woman is in nida, including in this is not just literally touching with hands, but even clothing touching, any physical contact whatsoever, even if it's clearly shloba derechiba, is something that is prohibited, that appears in the Gemara itself, so something which is out of the question. Again, it's not a hachaka deraisa, but shloba derechiba, but it's still prohibited midirabanan. Then you have perhaps the most famous of all the hachakas, which is also, it appears in Shulchan Aruch, it's quoted from the Rishonim, it's something that one has to observe properly, but it's not a deraisa for sure not, and it's not really actual touching. That's what's called handing things, passing things one to another. So we have an age-old practice to refrain from doing that. Husband and wife, vice versa, should not be handing things to each other directly when the woman is a nida. According to some Rishonim, the reason for that hachaka was is because if you do that, next thing you know, you're going to be actually touching. So what the source of that custom is, the source of this ration and tais, a lot of terrors about it. Tachlis the din is that the way it is, and one is supposed to observe this harchaka as well. This harchaka, of all the harchakas, sometimes draws attention to the fact that the woman is a nida, which obviously, as we spoke about before, we have to balance tznius. There's no reason to announce that when the woman is a sura muteris, as nobody's concerned. But on the other hand, if a couple finds themselves in a situation where it will draw attention, so you try as best as you can not to draw attention, you try as best to be as discreet as possible, but if it does, it does, and that's it. You have to observe the halachas in the Shulchan Aruch and the Minhag Yisrael, even if it does, by some chance, bring attention to the fact that the woman is a nida. So again, and this is very much Chochamena Barosho, a person shouldn't do anything that's obvious and blatant, you know, to scream across the table to his wife to pass something and then say, oh, well, no, you can't do that. Again, just common sense dictates, you should just plan accordingly, that the last thing we'd want to do is to violate the breach of tznius, and obviously to violate the sensitivity of one's wife. So one has to be very, very careful with the most seriousness, particularly in this achacha, because this achacha is something that women are very sensitive about. One has to be very, very careful about this. Some of the other hachakas, some of them actually appear in the Gemara themselves. One is in the realm of food. So we know that food is always associated with, people getting close to each other, spending time together. So therefore, the Mishnah actually tells us that a couple has to be careful when the woman is in nida, that the husband and the wife don't eat together. They're not supposed to be eating biyachad. What exactly eating biyachad means is a question in the Rishonim. Our minhag is, like those Rishonim will say, that eating at the same table is considered to be a problem, even if they're not literally eating from the same food, unless there is a hecker, unless there's some kind of a demarcation, some kind of something recognizable to always remind them that the woman is a nida. So that would mean either they eat, say, in a separate placemat or in a napkin or something, or something is placed on the table that's a little bit out of the ordinary to remind them. You can't put a bottle of soda down and then drink from the bottle of soda. So it has to be something that catches your attention that it doesn't belong here. Not all that different from the halachas of basa b'chalav. The din of basa b'chalav, if I'm eating fleishiks, if I'm eating milchiks, so we also shouldn't eat on the same table unless we make some kind of a demarcation. Many of the halachas in those areas are actually very, very similar to one another. According to some poskim, if there are other people around, so that in and of itself would mitigate the problem. So many a maker like that, especially the fact that when we eat together, so we're not really eating from the same plate per se, so according to some opinions, maybe that's not also in the first place, or maybe our tables are a little bit bigger than the olden tables. The olden tables were a little bit more, a little cozier, so a little closer proximity. For a variety of reasons, many poskim are maker on this. So I think that people have a right to be lenient. Again, those who have a shayla should ask their rabbanim, but I think there are many, many gedolei poskim who make el bezman hazeh to permit eating at the same table, provided there are other people around, which usually means, Hashem, you have kids running around the house, so then that's usually going to be enough of a hecker. If by some chance you have a moment of silence at some point in your life, so then you have to act accordingly. There are other things that are involved in food, which also could potentially lead to other things. So therefore, some of them are really also, some of them are b'toras minik, some of them is din, whatever it is. We're going to lump them all together today because l'maisa, you have to follow them. You have to follow minhag Yisrael also. Not just the din, we have to follow the standard minhag Yisrael. So the our minhag is that if a woman started to eat from something and you want to take that food afterwards, that's what's called shirei machola. So if she's munching away at something and then she finishes and you want to come and eat the shirayim, so that you shouldn't do. It's interesting, for some reason that only works in that direction. The other way is okay, because she probably is not going to do that. But if you want to eat the shirayim of ours, so then you're not really supposed to do that. Unless the shirayim were transferred to another plate or something, so there was a clear hecker that was made, that's not really hers. Let's say if she's taking a can of soda, so she drinks half the can and then she puts it down and hands it to you, so that's not right. So you're not supposed to drink that. You should pour it into a cup or something, make it transfer to something else. It shouldn't be literally shirari ma'achala. So that's also included in this overall hachaka in the realm of food. Similarly, the husband and wife should not be bringing food directly to each other at the table. It could be that the ikar adin, according to many, only refers to a cup of wine. Wine is the most serious of all of this. But our practice is, either b'toras din or b'toras minhag, that any handing of food, not even just handing, literally handing, is everything is out of the question, but even just placing down the plate of food in front of each other, that should be avoided, unless it's done either a little bit with a shinoi, either she puts it down with her left hand, or she puts it a little bit not directly in front of you. So again, that's usually very easy to do that, but you shouldn't put the whole plate down mamash right in front of you. Put that a little bit to the side, and you take it to yourself, so that's the post from a makela on that. So there should be a little bit. Again, the idea behind all of these archachas is mindset, that a person has to, it's almost like, not exactly the same era of halach, but it's similar, it's almost like Hilchos Pesach, that we have a lot of chumras and Hilchos Chametz, because Chametz is something that is sometimes permissible, most of the year it's permissible, so we have to be more machmer in those things that are sometimes permissible. So the harchakas, most of the poskim say the harchakas, interestingly enough, only apply to one's wife. They don't apply to somebody else. Let's say if a married woman is serving you, you happen to be eating, whatever, they put down a plate, that's okay. That's not a violation of harchakas. But if it's your own wife, so then you have to be more on guard because of the fact that she's half the month muteres, so you have to be a little bit even more careful. That's why Chazal instituted these different harchakas. There are other harchakas that take place, particularly in the bedroom. The Gemara speaks about the husband and wife are not permitted to sleep in the same bed, even if it's a very, very large bed, not near each other. That's clearly out of the question. And the Rishonim add on that even if they're technically two separate beds, but the beds are touching, so that's also should not be done. There should be a little bit of a break between the two. There are different minhagim, different suggestions given as to exactly how much room between the beds should be. So it's hard to give a number in stone. It's not written in stone what the number is. I think that the easy test that you just tell people just for convenience is called the roll test. Namely, if your bed is is you're on your bed and you roll off and you end up on the floor, then it's okay. Then it's okay. If you end up on the other bed, that's a little bit too close. So some poskim mamish give that shear. So one should, again, one should use common sense in this. Sometimes it gets a little bit tricky if you have a little baby. So sometimes the woman is nursing or something in the middle of the night, the baby's there, and something can get a little dangerous. Khalil, the baby should roll. Again, you have to use, just figure out how to do things. They're smart. You shouldn't end up in violating these harchakas. Chacham made a barosho in many, many, most areas of life. That's always a good etza. Also in the area of the bedroom, so the Gemara talks about that the wife shouldn't be making the bed, or vice versa, on behalf of the husband. If the husband is there, the husband's standing there and watching, and she's popping up the pillows and making up, you know, making the sheets, make everything look nice, so that's not appropriate. That also, that's not appropriate, that's also, that's one of the hachakas that Chazal speak about as well. If the husband's not there, the husband's doing it for the wife, so as long as the other person's not present, that wouldn't pose a problem. Similarly, the Rishonim added on that the husband shouldn't sit on his wife's bed. He shouldn't lay on his wife's bed. According to many, he shouldn't sit on his wife's bed. Whichever bed is miyuchat for her, when she's in nida, so the husband should be off limits, should be off for those 2 weeks of the month, so he shouldn't be sitting, shouldn't be laying, shouldn't anything related to her place. If you have a couch in the living room, so sometimes he'll lay down Shabbos afternoon, she'll lay down Shabbos afternoon, that's not called mita miyuchedes la, that would be permissible. There is an important area of hachaka that's sometimes a little bit difficult to define, and it can really depend a little bit subjectively, and that's what's called tzchok v'kalas rosh, that the Shulchan Aruch quotes that a couple has to be careful not to involve themselves in inappropriate kinds of discussions and behavior and frivolous kinds of activity when the woman is in nida. So this is a very, very tricky thing because it's hard to pinpoint what exactly is called divrei chibam, it's called divrei tzchok, different couples have different things. Sometimes, a lot of the chassanim ask the famous question, are you allowed to say, the words, I love you to your wife when she's in nida? So the mesura that I have is that it depends. It mamish depends on the context. If it's an I love you that's said in a romantic setting, eating a candlelight dinner, that's not appropriate. Those kinds of things that should not be said when the woman is a nida. On the other hand, if you're coming home an hour and a half late from work and you're it's more of a pikuach nefesh, you just want to say something, that's a different question. So it could be the same three words that mean different. I kid you not, this is the Messiah. The same three words can mean different things in different contexts, so I don't want to say also mutter. The same is true for all kinds of like trips and vacation and those kinds of things. The post can talk about, we didn't mention before, the safsum nedes, about sitting on the same kind of a bench and those kinds of things, or going on trips together, the post can talk about. So it depends on what kind of trip is. There are trips and there are trips. So if a couple should try to plan, if a couple is going alone on a vacation, they should try to plan the vacation accordingly, around the cycle. Doesn't always happen. So she becomes a need, they weren't expecting it. So you don't necessarily have to cancel the vacation, but it should be, the activity should be appropriate. Usually as a guideline that I remember when I got married, so the Rav who I spoke to, so he gave me a simple guideline. He said, you should always ask yourself the following question. Is this the kind of a trip that you would take, you would go on a roommate with? Would you go with your roommate to Disneyland? Yeah. So then make her dinner's mutter. I didn't say consider this. It may be a trip. Amusement parks are probably not a good place to go when she's in either, because you sit in the same car. That's not shayach, not to touch. So that would be out of the question. I'm saying, you want to do in some kind of a, entertainment, kind of a fun kind of a place that's not romantic in nature, that mikra din is mutter. But other kinds of things that are clearly husband and wife activities, so those are things that should not be taking place when the woman is in either. We move on to the last topic. When I started off by saying I'm going to try to do the impossible and cover all chazid, and now I'm going to do the impossible. I'm going to try to finish all of Hilchos Vestas in 2 minutes and 15 seconds. So I'm going to try to. So we'll just give literally the Rosh Hashanah, and then we'll spend. We'll give you a few extra minutes at the end for some questions. The Gemara tells us that when the woman is expecting to become a nida, she's not even a nida yet. She's not expecting to become a nida. So then the couple are not permitted to be together. When we say not to be together, Me'ikra din, that means not to have relations. Some are machmir, not to have other kinds of physical contact. Hachachas don't apply during this almost time of nida. But the other physical contacts of kissing, hugging, things like that is a question. But actual relations are clearly out of the question. What does it mean she's about to become a nida? I don't know if Ruach HaKodesh. How would I know when she's going to become a nida? So the answer is based on what our past records are. So this is basically all of Hilchos Vestas. All the Vestas means only the time, the cycle she's expecting her period. So depending on when her previous periods were, that's when we're going to make it almost an educated guess when her next period is going to be. And right before that, we're going to refrain from having relations. What are the different factors that go into making this educated guess? So there are many of them that revolve around the calendar. Some revolve around her body. So we'll go very, very quickly through them. And the ones that revolve around the calendar are as follows. Whatever the Hebrew date that when she got her last period was, so she has to be concerned. If she got her period on Chof Tishrei, so when Chof Cheshvan rolls around, there's a chance. Not necessarily, but there's a chance that she may get a period again. So that's called a period of avesis, and she would not be permitted to have relations during that short period of time. We'll see in a minute what that short period of time is. Then you have, in addition to that, you have what's called a hafluga, which means that what her past interval was, namely the amount of days between the last period and the previous period. So if she's a woman who the last period was a 34-day interval, so then when 34 days come now, she has to be concerned. Maybe she's repeating, if she hasn't gotten a period yet, maybe she's repeating what happened from last month's interval. That's what's called a hafluga. So you can already begin to see that a woman has to start to keep track. Every time she gets a period, she has to know what's the date, what's the interval, because it's going to affect next month. In addition to all that, she has to do what's called an onabeninus. Onabeninus means an approximate for a median, you know, what many women have, most women have, approximately 30 days. There's a question in the poskim, is that approximately 30 days or 31 days? Me'ikra din, we paskin, it's approximately, it's the 30th day. That's the way we paskin, me'ikra din. There are those who are machmir, to do both, but we're just, since we're 9 seconds overdue, we're going to leave out the chumras now. Just the ikra din is that the 30th day after the last period, she has to be concerned as well. Those are the three basic dates on the calendar the woman has to be aware of. When the next month comes around, she has to always ask herself, when she gets close to getting a period, so she has to start asking herself, is this an onabeninus? Is this a chodesh? Is this a yom haflaga? Those are the basic questions that she has to ask. When we say she has to ask around the date, there's a big question, does that mean just the time of day? Maybe let's say she got her last period in the daylight hours. So when the 30th day comes around, or the Yom HaChodesh HaFlog comes around, the daylight hours she has to be concerned, or even the night before. Or let's say last time she got it in the nighttime hours, does she have to be concerned even the day before? So that's a big question. The Shulchan Aruch Mikra Din Paskins that you only have to observe that in a sense 12-hour interval, so to speak. It means either you're a day person or a night person, depending on what happened last month. That's the Ikra Din. There are those who will follow practice, what's called in the world today, the Chumra Dira Zaruah, who says that you have to keep what's called the owner before. So if you were a day person, you have to consider the night before as well. There are different practices, different customs, different communities about this. So I want you to consult whoever they're getting guidance for in this area, whether they should follow this Chumra or not. Again, we're just trying to map out what the Ikra Din is. In addition to Anissa Tashmish, there are also dinim that govern bedikas during these periods, and there are different shitas as to how many and when, which bedikas have to be done. So a woman, just every month, the most important things for a woman to be aware of is when her onabeninus is, when her Yom HaChodesh is, when her Yom HaFlag is, both in terms of refraining from relations, as well as when is the appropriate time to be doing bedikas, possibly at different ones of those different times of days on the calendar. Just depending on how the calendar plays out, sometimes these intervals overlap. Sometimes you can have a woman who she gets all three on the same day, so that's good. Sometimes you get 3 days in a row, that's not so good. So again, depending on how her body and the calendar are in sync, so she has to always know which day was on, day of the month, what the interval was, or the last two, and what the onabeninus is, and always be aware, is it a daytime or is it a nighttime? Day and night, for these purposes, are determined by sunrise to sunset, unlike in other areas of Allah, again, beyond right now. One other thing that she has to be aware of, which is makes Vestas a little bit more complicated today, is that sometimes she can have certain things that she's doing that can alter the Vestas a little bit. The Gemara talks about she eats certain foods. Certain foods bring on the period. So if she eats those foods, for the last 10 years, every time she eats the onions, the garlic, whatever the Gemara describes, she always gets a period right away. So then if she eats onion and garlic at a certain time, then she has to be concerned that she's going to get a period. Today, we don't obviously attribute periods in that sense. We don't have that bodies work with such clockwork with foods so much, but we have pills today. So very often a woman is on medication. Again, she can only be on these medications with the proper psach of a rav, but she's on some kind of a medication that's pretty much regulating her cycle. So she knows exactly when she's going to get a period. She's going to come off the regular birth control pill, she's going to take a placebo, and 24 to 48 hours later, she's going to get a period. So that's a whole other kind of avesis. That's a different kind of avesis. So it could be that once she's on these pills, that you don't have to take as serious everything we spoke about up until now. The 30 days is not so important anymore. And the Yom HaChodesh, you know, nothing really matters. What really matters, if her body's working like clockwork, so now she has to take into consideration what the pills are saying. So if according to the way her pills are posketing, that she's going to get a period in the next, you know, a few hours, so that's considered to be like a vestes, with all the halachas of Hilchos Vestes. So again, any woman who's on medication and wants to know how to work a vestes around, that has to be in contact with the Rav to give her the proper guidance, but just to be aware that this is a very, very common application. In theory, a woman could reach the point where she gets what's called a vestes kavua, that she gets 3 days in a row, three months in a row, and then she has a whole new status in terms of Hilchos Vestes. We're not going to talk about it. It's not that common to happen. The only time it really happens is when she's on pills. So anyway, it's a different status. For a woman likely to get a Vestes Kavua, it happens once in a blue moon, but it does happen. If and when a woman sees that it's happening, she should contact her up. So the bottom line is, she should keep a good, solid record. Whether she wants to do it the old style, like the Chayyodim says, with paper and pencil, whether she wants to mark on a calendar, whether she wants to have a computer program, whatever she wants, whatever works for her, she should keep track of all her eels for the last several months to be able to keep an idea, to be able to present, to know how to keep, to observe Hilchos Vestes properly. Okay. Right, so we'll take just a couple minutes of questions.
During the Vestas, does she keep all
the Rechakas? No, so she doesn't have to keep any of the Rechakas during the Vestas. The Vestas themselves, Tashmish, actual relations are Asur. The Ikar Adin, other physical contact, is technically Mutter. There are those who are Machmer on that. So those who, the Shach was a Kohen, he says he'll give a Bracha to anyone who keeps it. So the Kohen gives a Bracha. I'm not going to turn back the Shach's Bracha. But the Ikar Adin, it's not necessary. So again, they should contact with the Rav, whether they want to follow that Chumra or not. But the Rechakas proper are permissible.
Hormonal replacement therapy after Misulika Damim gives to some woman and they retrieve and they get back to the period.
Right. So
we consider this as...
Yes, absolutely. If a woman is having blood that's coming from the uterus, so it doesn't matter, you know...
Even after Misulika Damim.
At any point. So even a woman who's pregnant is having anything, or nursing, any time, if the bottom line is if it's uterine bleeding, so that's considered to be Dam Nidus in Halacha. As again, also, in theory, she could become, she can become a needle also, yeah.
If a woman has a bedika and she finds a bad powder on it, does she have to keep that cycle?
No, the halacha is that vestas follow ias. They don't follow ksamim. And even though it says in Shulchan Aruch that if you have an eight bodok, if you have a real bedika, so that can create a vestas, many people can say that's only to create a vestas kavua. If it's just a vestas in a kavua, which is the one which is 99.9% of the time we have anyway, so one could be making on that.
In the scenario where you allowed a woman to be told about wearing a ring because it wasn't a chatzitza, does the ring have to be moved around under the water? And then if there's a nose or an ear stub or something like that, which you didn't call it a chatzitza, does it have to be moved?
Well, those things are going to be more problematic. The ring, the only reason why I was making sometimes on the ring, if the ring is mamish movable, the water is getting under. If you put your hand in a cup of water, your whole finger will be wet. It's just that the ring, your knuckle is so swollen it can't get over. Once you have other things that are in other parts of the body, that becomes more problematic.
The nose also, you can move it out, but you can't pull it out necessarily.
I don't know. The bottom line is, if it can't be taken out and water can get under it, and the water is getting under it, then it's okay. It's not like the mouth. In the mouth, you don't have to open your mouth to get the water in. You have to have what's called royal biyasmayim. On the body, you need biyasmayim mamish, so the water has to mamish get there. So if it's something's blocking the water from getting there, even though it's loose, that's going to be a problem.
Can he use her toothbrush?
I think so.
Even without that help.
I wouldn't recommend it the rest of the month, but I think it's...
We don't recommend that.
During that help, can he change a baby on her bed?
You change a baby in a bed? I think you change a baby in a bed, yeah.
To little El Soup, is that like Mazigas HaKos? That's also the bottom. Maybe for her to ladle soup from a pot into his bowl, in the kit, that's in the eating laws of the kitchen.
Really, and she's gonna put it directly onto the bowl.
Onto the bowl, but and then she's gonna serve it with the shinoi. But
yeah, that's okay. No, the bowl's gonna make it like that, because the only time it's really also if it's both the maziga and the presentation, everything is done kedarko. That's okay. If you do a little bit of change in anything, meikra din maziga is a ghost. The only cousin. Yeah, I think so. I think you can make it like that.
Discuss for a minute about. sitting on the same bench, sitting on the same couch, a plush couch with pillows
right.
and all.
Right, right. So sitting, the Ramah quotes a practice not to sit on a safsal, it's not made when it almost kind of moves together. If it's a more of a, like a car kind of a setup, so the Ramah is making on that. But if it's something that really moves from the fact that you're moving, I sit down on the couch, and your wife is sitting right next to me, and you can feel the vibration a little bit, so that's something that should not be done. That's the minig of the Ramah, not to sit on such a thing.
Let's say you bought airline tickets, you're going to Israel in a year, and the time comes, and now she's Anita, and you know that you're going to sit next to her, she's very afraid on the plane.
On the plane, yeah.
So how far do you go with her hookahs if
You try
to have a big loss by losing the ticket, but at the same time, there's a good chance they can't move your seat on the plane and all that.
You sit next to your wife when she's in either on the plane. You try your best, not the.
Her behavior. She's I don't know. She's extremely afraid of planes.
I can't talk for me to get into that. try your best.
Handing a child to your wife during her chuppah.
There are different opinions about the handing of a child. Some of the poskim have discussion about they quote Sugis Menuchas Shabbos. Chai Nosi Az Atzmo. It's not so partial that Sugis has any relevance at all to this. It's a different Sugis halachot altogether. Or some who are mekel, there are different opinions about this. There are some who are mekel when they feel it's a sorach hatinoch. They feel it's for the need for the baby. So the Shulchan Aruch quotes that you're allowed to be making lachok. You shouldn't mention you're allowed to be making lachok because we have a chulish ein b'sakana. So when let's say the wife has to be taken care of, the husband, no one else around take care of the wife. So the husband's allowed to mamash do certain things that would otherwise be a chok because it's a chulish ein b'sakana. So there are some who suggested that maybe it's not just the kula of the wife's the chulish ein b'sakana. If anyone's a chulish ein b'sakana, so baby is always a chulish ein b'sakana. So somebody again, there are different opinions about this. And if you look in the regular standard. Hilchos Nida books that are printed today, you won't see the skula, but that's why I had to come to Yiddish in Boston, so Yom Piyah Shmua, that there are some who are lenient on that they consider that to be also a shtich makom makom chalashim is a gunner. The person who originally told me the skula said that the skula came into existence because they saw somebody handing to the other spouse the baby on top of a car, and the baby almost rolled off, and they said, I got to come up with some kind of an aid to him. So again, there are different opinions about this.
After a woman gives birth, there's sort of an associated uterine bleeding with that, no?
Yeah.
Does that render her anita? And if so, for how long?
Well, she's anita from the fact that she gives birth. Well, anytime a woman gives birth, automatically she's anita. We didn't even really even talk about childbirth. But the bottom line is a woman is always anita when she gives birth, and even a little bit before she gives birth, she will probably become anita. She remains anita until she can do a hefsek tahor and shiva nikiyum. That's good. May take a while, so it usually takes approximately 6 weeks, some women a little bit early, some women a little bit later, but she has to do like any other woman to wait to be able to get up to the town she came in.
When she says Nida and Friday she will do the challah, is there any problem of dealing with the Issa and the camel and doing the challah actually?
Well, is she supposed to go to the mikveh that night or just general?
Just in general, she is...
No, that's fine, that's perfectly okay.
Just going back to... Yes, that was the
right. 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 Well, today we don't observe all these dinim of tum v'tahara food because we're all tummy. Anyone who ever went to a cemetery funeral is always tummy. So all our food, it's a couple of waters, everything's tummy. Unless the kli's done a couple of tumah maybe a lot of lumbus. But we all eat food that's tummy, so that doesn't really consider us. I thought you were asking if she has to go to the mikveh that night. So okay. Then the post can say she shouldn't need dough. It's not a good idea to be needing dough. Go to the mikveh at night because you can get dough stuck. Yeah.
After Avesta, does she have to make a bediga?
She has to do a bedika b'shas avesta. She's supposed to do. If she forgot to do a bedika b'shas avesta, so if it was a veses kavua or an onabenis, it's like a veses kavua, then she has to do a bedika before she's permitted to her husband.
And she's also told
that. Yeah. Only by veses kavua. Veses shen kavua, then she's muteris. Not everyone even agrees she has to do a bedika during a veses shen kavua. It's a different story. But even those who hold that she has to do a bedika, b'diavad of the veses passed, unless it was a veses kavua, an onabenis, she wouldn't have to.
On
a basis, it's like a Vesas Kavua, yeah.
And
during,
we say B'Shas HaVesas, the 12 hours.
Right, so B'Ikra didn't any time during the Shas HaVesas. There are different opinions how many B'Dikas there. So some will say she has to do two, some say one is good enough. I usually recommend it's better to do a little bit later in the day because the idea is you want to prove that she wasn't bleeding. The B'Ikra didn't smoke to any time during the day.
During
during the seven clean days, is a woman supposed to sleep on a white sheet?
Yes, yeah, so I should have mentioned it. There are different minhagim about this. In the olden days, so the answer was yes, that she should be sleeping on a white sheet. Bizman Azeh, many people can question whether that really applies, because Bizman Azeh, the women wear underwear. So any kesem that she's going to find is going to show up in the underwear anyway. In the olden days, people didn't sleep in underwear, sleep in pajamas, nothing. So then if she's bleeding, so then that's like wearing, so to speak, white. Bizman Azeh, what are you wearing? What do you have a white sheet for? It's not gonna help one way or the other. Either the kesem will be on the underwear, won't be at all. So there are still many people who still, you know, many of us in the Biodana, there are many women who still use white sheets during Shiva Nikim, but there are many who don't.
You spoke about the sensitivity of your wife, and typically a woman is thinking about their own emotions more than halacha. So on a dark night on Shabbos, they demand that you hold their hand. And they're Anita.
Yeah.
You know, based on Shalom Bias.
You know,
it's a
very, very tricky thing. You know, there's no question that we try as much as possible sensitivity. You know, we can never ever emphasize enough the significance of sensitivity in all areas of human relationships, kavachomer with one's wife, and kavachomer when a woman is a little bit, you know, prone to, you know, a little bit even feeling that extra need of sensitivity when she's in nida. On the other hand, something that's absolutely prohibited by the halacha is something that's difficult. You know, again, if a couple has this particular issue, it would really be a good idea to sit down with a rav who knows. You know, it's hard for me as an outsider to speak. Someone who knows the rav and understands where the husband and the wife are coming from to try to kind of help them work out a way that the wife feels comfortable and yet there's no absolute violation of halacha. So I think it's a very, very important point, and it's something that has to be addressed more of halachic slash, you know, hashkafic slash, you know, shalom bayis type of a setting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.